administration and personnel
in the public service. Performance management and development systems in the public service is a challenge facing public servants in terms of alignment with strategic plan of respective departments. While some employees are of the view that the system is objective, whereas others say it is subjective, the Public Service Commission has evaluated the effectiveness of the performance management and development system for the public service. Former Minister of the DPSA and Minister of Finance have announced of the phasing out performance bonuses in 2021. If we really want to professionalize the public service, government needs to come up with a better system to manage individual performances. We will later receive presentation on the micro reconfiguration of the state by Department of Public Service and Administration. I would therefore like to call on the Public Service Commission to take us through its presentation. If the Commission is ready, you can take the floor.
Good morning, honourable members. Thank you, Chairperson. Good morning, Minister. I'm going to start with a background which I think honourable Chair has already outlined, some of what we as the Public Service Commission has investigated and what we were concerned about. The objectives of the study was to establish the underlying reasons for the ineffective implementation of the PMDS in the public service. The following were the specific objectives of the study. First of all, to determine whether there is sufficient alignment between the medium-term strategic framework, the strategic plan, the APP, and the performance agreements of senior management service members in the public service. To outline processes that enhance or hinder the effective implementation of the PMDS, and to establish whether poor performance interventions or mechanisms are implemented adequately by the responsible managers as provided in the legislative and policy framework. Also to establish if individual PMDS outcomes and rewards are comparable with the organizational goals, objectives and performance, and then to present the findings and propose recommendations aimed at addressing the challenges and weaknesses in the implementation. I may just also want to say, honourable members, when we look at performance management and development, the system that is used in the public service, obviously we are looking at that in the context of the President's State of the Nation address, where one of the concerns or one of the seven areas was the performance of the state. We also understand that in the National Development Plan, there is a chapter 13, that deals with the performance of the state. And the intention is to ensure that we have a capable and developmental state. Also, of course, if we look at the PMDS in the context of whether government is delivering on what it's supposed to be delivering and whether departments are fulfilling their mandates, you then get to the point where you have to assess the effectiveness of the department itself and the individuals in that particular department. So I'm going to skip the slide that deals with methodology, except to say that we have included in our study, because of the broadness of the public service, we have selected six departments, which are mentioned on that particular slide. Methodology, we made use of primary and secondary data. And then in terms of the limitations of the study, obviously we had to select only a few departments. There were also challenges in as far as some SMS members were not always available for the interviews that we wanted to conduct with them. But we believe that because of the multiple data sources we have consulted, that it should enhance the validity of our findings. So skipping to the slide that deals with our findings, the first one, to assess whether there's sufficient alignment between the MTSF, the Departmental Strategic Plan, the APP, and the performance agreements of SMS members. Departments are required to use the National Development Plan and MTSF as guidelines when developing departmental strategic plans and their annual performance plans. Strategic plans and APPs enable departments to be more responsive by addressing medium to long-term strategic goals and objectives, whilst also incorporating emerging policy priorities at any departmental level. In addition, departments are still expected to develop detailed operational plans or work plans to cater for critical mandatory work and new priorities. A review of the key strategic documents revealed that there is, on paper, alignment amongst the identified documents across all the participating departments which we have looked at. The study found that there was alignment between the departmental strategic plans, the APPs, and SMS members' performance agreements. Some departments relied more on branch operational plans when drafting their senior management members' PAs. This was mainly due to the fact that the branch operational plans were more detailed and covered critical strategic plan, performance targets, and other mandatory or emerging priorities. With regards to ensuring alignment in terms of KRAs, KPIs and weights, as well as the adherence to SMART principles, departments relied on the PMDS units, but some departments have various committees that are established to ensure alignment and adherence to these principles. Then in terms of objective number two, processes and practices that enhance or hinder the implementation of the PMDS, departmental policies contributing towards the effectiveness of the PMDS, participants were requested to specify whether the current departmental policies used contribute towards the effectiveness of the PMDS. In the Department of Health, for example, the Strategic Planning, Monitoring and Planning Unit ensures that related departmental policies contribute towards the effectiveness of the PMDS. Policies regarding probation, skills development, training and development complement the PMDS, though they are implemented separately from the PMDS policy. Departments such as human settlements, rural development and land reform, as well as water and sanitation, indicated that their policies were either outdated or non-existent, and they relied mostly on the SMS handbook or DPSA directives as guidelines. Some of the findings we had in as far as objective number two, we find that the department's capacity to roll out PMDS effectively, lack of capacity was raised by PMDS practitioners from all departments that participated in the study. This was supported by the SMS members who were interviewed. The PMDS to staff complement ratio, in other words, the number of PMDS officials who have to administer the system in relation to the number of employees for basic education, there were 10 staff members in the ratio of for 750 staff members. In health, the ratio was 6 to 1,834 employees. For human settlements, was 3 to 600. Rural development, 6 to 5,400. And transport, 2 to 650. And water and sanitation, 6 to 7,000. This means that PMDS practitioners, instead of also focusing on some of the developmental aspects, basically has to focus on just supporting the process issues rather than with content. So there's limitations in terms of what they can do, for example, relating to the quality of a performance agreement, some of the linkages that there needs to be between the performance agreement as well as the stated objectives of the department. Then in terms of objectives, the same objective number two, processes and practices that enhance or hinder the implementation of the PMDS, the contribution of PDPs, which means personal development plans, towards employee and departmental performance. The intention of personal development plans is to contribute towards improved employee and departmental performance. This means that if between the supervisor and the supervisee, if there is an acknowledgement that there's a particular weakness or an area of learning or development area for a specific employee, that a personal development plan would then be drafted on the basis of which such an employee would then be able to be upskilled in order to perform his or her functions better. In the Department of Basic Education, we did not find evidence that PDPs contribute towards employee and departmental performance because PDPs and training needs has not been given much attention. There was very little or no feedback with regards to training and development to SMS members by the HRD unit. The same applied with the Departments of Health, Human Settlement and Transport, where participants indicated that the correlation between the two factors could not be determined. The Department of Rural Development indicated that this was the responsibility of the Human Resource Development Unit, but there is no platform for information sharing between the HRD and PMDS units, and the two processes did not complement each other in this particular department. Then we looked at the issue of subjectivity versus objectivity and fairness during SMS member performance assessments. According to the participants, there is perceived favoritism by some supervisors, which results in performance bonuses being awarded to others, whilst those who may be deserving get nothing. This perception tends to be heightened in instances where there is a disagreement between parties during the drafting of performance agreements, and this then extends to performance reviews and assessments. The Department of Health has developed performance standards that indicate the basis of performance assessment and what constitutes effective performance or performance above effective in order to minimize subjectivity in the process. So basically what that means is that for a specific level of performance, there would be a descriptor that would basically describe to say, if your performance is effective, this is more or less what we will see. If it's above effective, then there are certain things that we have to look for. Participants have also proposed that departments must ensure that performance agreements are realistic and supervisors must be trained and held accountable for managing performance with honesty and integrity to minimize subjectivity. In as far as objective number 3 of the study, the implementation of poor performance intervention mechanisms by the responsible managers, supervisors as provided in the legislative and policy framework. So there are certain steps that a manager and a department has to follow when they identify that a specific employee, when that person's performance is poor. This section in our study provides a generalized response to how departments are dealing with poor management, with poor performance in the management of the PMDS, and the role of managers and supervisors in this process. The PMDS practitioners affirm that poor management of the PMDS process is not tolerated. Hence, mechanisms such as disciplinary action are put in place to address the matter where this has been established. Branch heads have a responsibility to monitor how the PMDS is managed and initiate corrective measures in cases of dereliction of duty. If there is no improvement, the matter should then be escalated to the Labor Relations Unit for punitive actions to be taken against the supervisors or their subordinates. This would happen, honorable members, when in fact, for example, an employee does not take the responsibility of drafting his or her initial performance agreement, or where there's dereliction of duty from the supervisor of such employee, where the supervisor has not ensured that such a performance agreement is indeed entered into. There are some of the grievances that come to the Public Service Commission where employees would be aggrieved either because there's no performance agreement that has been entered into, or there's no agreement in terms of the content of the performance agreement, or we may even find that the performance assessment meetings that's supposed to take place between the supervisor and the supervisee are not happening at the intervals that they should be happening, for example, quarterly. We have had grievances where one of the objections from the specific employee was that all the quarterly reviews performance assessment reviews were done on the same day when in fact it should be done per quarter. So in terms of the intervention mechanisms by the responsible managers, with respect to poor performance by individual SMS members on agreed key result areas, our study identified less than 5 cases. The poor performance in these cases was dealt with by the department in line with the PMDS, but there were 2 cases that were also dealt with in terms of the employee health and wellness program, where, for example, it may be identified that the employee has a problem, whether it's with regards to physical health or mental health, and such a person's poor performance is then ascribed to this problem, in which case the person would then have to find support through the employee health and wellness program of such department. To establish the objective number 4, to establish if individual PMDS outcomes and rewards are comparable with organizational objectives and performance, we try to look at whether these individual PMDS outcomes and financial rewards are comparable with organizational objectives and performance. So basically what that graph means is we look at the overall expenditure by the specific department, then we look at the performance against their planned targets, and then in the next column, performance incentives paid to levels 2 to 12, and then also performance incentives paid to senior managers, which is level 13 and above, and then we would look at what was the audit outcome of that department. One of the reasons why we would do that is because there were instances where we would find that in some departments, senior managers were receiving performance incentive bonuses, but yet the department's overall performance on reaching their objectives, but also in terms of the audit by the AG, you'll find that there's a disjuncture. So the idea obviously is that you can't have a department where a substantial amount of money is paid out to in terms of performance bonuses, and yet that department has a poor audit outcome or they have not reached all of their objectives. So if we look at the departments there, we have health, we have spent over this period that we were looking at 99.4% of their budget, has reached 59.5% of their planned targets, and then they've paid out 29.7% of their findings, of their employees on levels 2 to 12, and 4.1% of employees levels 13 and above. So although they got an unqualified with findings, obviously the red, which we are highlighting, would mean that actually they did not perform that well in terms of the targets that they have set for themselves. If we look at transport, they spend 99.7% of their budget. They reached about 90% of their objectives. But by the time that they were supposed to, their audit was not finalized by the legislated date. Rural development, not achieving such a good performance in terms of their targets, but they did get an unqualified audit. Same with water and sanitation. They spent so much of their budget, and then they've only managed to reach 41% of their targets, but they did get an unqualified with findings. So the concern, which is not what we have really focused on that much, but obviously if a department has managed to spend all their money, but they have not actually managed to reach all of their targets, then there is a disjuncture that one would then look at to what extent have people been paid performance incentives and rewards. And you will see with water and sanitation, at least for that specific period, no senior manager has received a performance incentive payment, and it's a way of acknowledging that yes, we may have had an unqualified audit outcome, but the performance in terms of service delivery targets out there was not that good, and one would not expect such a department then to pay out performance bonuses to their employees. One of the issues we also looked at in terms of objective 4 of the study was to establish if individual PMDS outcomes and rewards are comparable with the organizational objectives and performance. According to the table in the previous slide, all departments spend more than 95% of their budget. I did speak to that. The only one department managed to achieve 90% of their targets. See there, what was the situation of human settlements and basic education, and then the other departments who all achieved less than 60% of their planned targets. With regards to their audit outcomes, not that bad. And then we see that the Department of Transport, as I've indicated, did not finalize the audit by the legislative date. So in the light of some of these challenges that we have picked up as the Public Service Commission were the following recommendations. I must just remind members that the report that is presented, this report was finalized in June 2018. So there has been development since the time that we have finalized the report. We have been in discussion with DPSA, who in fact has already taken up a number of the recommendations that we've made at the time. The following proposed recommendations were made with a view to address the challenges. Departments should review the capacity of their PMDS units in terms of human resources and competency requirements in relation to their staff complement. This is obviously something that's probably still outstanding because you'll find that the people who are responsible may be just HR, maybe HR people who are not necessarily capacitated to deal with the content of the performance agreements, who may not necessarily be capacitated in terms of how to properly link the objectives of the department with the performance agreements of the officials. So they would be there to make sure that the process happens and that people are meeting their deadlines and that the moderation committee sits once the assessment has been done. So a number of these people have capacity, but more so on the process side of managing the PMDS. Standards and indicators regarding key result areas need to be established so that the application of scoring is done scientifically and based on pre-established norms. Greater attention needs to be given to the separation of financial incentives and the developmental focus of the PMDS. This, however, would require additional research before implementation. As was announced by Honourable Chairperson already, the Minister of Public Service and Administration and the Department have announced that they are in the process of phasing out the monetary awards that are currently linked to the performance development system, and we are grateful that at least that part is being addressed. Consideration needs to be given to the introduction of some form of group or peer evaluation as part of the PMDS system for the senior management service. SMS members must be compelled to participate in awareness opportunities on the application of the PMDS, and non-compliance must be dealt with in line with prescripts. As I've indicated, Honourable Members, some of the grievances that are escalated to the Public Service Commission, because we are dealing with grievances, at some point we did find that there is quite a high number of grievances which are linked to performance, to the performance management and development system. And this was one of the reasons why we conducted the study. But over and above that, we have found that the policy is there. And although there are some challenges linked to the policy, we have found that a number of the grievances actually stem from the incorrect implementation of the policy as it is. So a number of times we've had to indicate that departments are interpreting or applying the PMDS policy incorrectly, especially with regards to the changing of the scores of employees when there's an agreement between an employee and the supervisor that this is the score that should be allocated, and then what the department finds at the end of the process is either they are not within the 5% allocation that they can use in relation to the wage bill, and then instead of finding proper mechanisms to make sure that they stay within the amount that is allocated, then what they will do is reduce the scores of employees in order to get to that budgeted amount. And we've had to point out, no, but there are other ways in which you have to do that. You can't reduce the scores of employees. If an employee has done well, then you can't reduce the score, because that would then mean that the employee has not done as well as there was agreement to. So the other mechanisms that departments have to become very knowledgeable about as to how they should manage the budgetary allocation for incentive rewards. The DPSA, as the custodian of the HRM framework, should lead a change management process in terms of the newly introduced PMDS policy framework to deal with the challenges raised regarding implementation and the realignment of PMDS units in departments. And this discussion between us and DPSA is ongoing, and as I have indicated, there are processes in place already to address some of these challenges. In conclusion, the findings of the study demonstrate that the PMDS cannot be invalidated on the basis that it is perceived to be a system of awarding employee performance bonuses regardless of their performance or contribution to the performance of the organization. So there is a need to implement the PMDS in an objective manner, but that also ensures accountability for all responsible officials. So even though there is a history that officials in the public service have gotten to the point where they see the PMDS only as a way of getting a notch increase or getting a performance bonus at the end of the year, and the proper meaning of the PMDS, where in as much as it relates to the performance of the department as well as the performance of an individual in that department, and the linking of the two, and using it in order to improve the performance of both the department and the individuals in that department. And we do believe that once that delinking is in place, that hopefully the initially intended purpose for the PMDS will be more able to be realized. Because for now, what we see is that people are using the PMDS system, that is the employees, in order to be able to get the bonuses that they want, and it defeats the purpose of the system. There is also a need to ensure that there is consequence management, which if there is a lack of consequence management, it makes it difficult to deal with deviations and discrepancies and inconsistencies. During the course of conducting the study, it was found that the DPSA did introduce, as I've said, the new PMDS framework. We cannot say that this will rule out the possibility of a recurrence of some of the challenges, and so we need to give the new system time to actually be utilized and to see what other challenges are thrown out by the system. There will be still a need to address the capacity of PMDS units, as I've indicated, and also to start working with SMS members and employees in general to change their attitude towards the system. There is a need to provide the necessary training and development, which will play a critical role in ensuring effective implementation of the new system. It is further noted that the PSC did present the report, as I've said, to the DPSA senior management team in March this year, and they will also consider the findings and recommendations as they roll out the new PMDS system, and the PSC will continue to monitor the rolling out of the new system. Thank you, Honourable Members. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Honourable Members, by way of apologies that should be officially recorded, we received apologies from Honourable Cebekhulu, Honourable Sibisi, and Honourable Mukaus. Are there any apologies that were sent through that we did not recognize? Nothing. Okay. Honourable Black?
Can I just ask before you move on, I'd like to wish my colleague, Dr. Leon Schreiber, a very happy birthday today. Thank you.
Okay.
Okay, that's. We will sing for him later.
As long as I don't have to sing that.
Okay. Thank you. Honorable Minister, can we now give you the opportunity to just give us a brief overview?
Well, I would rather suggest that because we're dealing with an independent entity, we give the portfolio committee the first bite, and then perhaps we can come in later,
right,
just to ensure their independence.
All right.
Let me take hands. I can see your hand, comrade. And comrade, sorry, honorable Mutipe, Clark, Schreiber, Malazi, and Soma in that order. Last, then you will be the final speaker. The floor is yours.
Thank you, Chairperson. We welcome the presentation from the Public Service Commission and greetings to the leadership that is amongst us, particularly the minister. Chair, I think the Public Service Commission is playing a pivotal role in our country to make it sure that things happen. I wanted to check a few things. In her presentation, she mentioned that they picked up a few departments. I don't know whether she was meaning the one that are aligning, but I just wanted to check to say if they were picking, what criteria were they using, and what is it that they want to achieve by picking those few. But Chair, in terms of capacity, to roll out a capacity for PMDs, there is this formula that they gave us. Now I wanted to check the ratios that she was mentioning to say in terms of the ratios that she gave us here. What is it that is supposed to be in place initially? I'm trying to get to this ratio, but she knows them, eh?
Yes.
Yeah. What is it that is supposed to be in place? And according to what is reflecting, how does that affect the whole work of the public service? She also mentioned something very crucial, the rating of people according to favoritism, to say at least they did pick up that. But I wanted to check something. I've got a living example that I know from one of the national departments, to say my question to them is that are they able to get into the bones of departments in terms of the things that are happening The living example that I wanted to highlight, Chairperson, is whereby a director linked with favoritism, a director will not assign any work to a worker. Anything, no task assigned. And that person will be paid by government for the whole year or 2 years, sitting there in the department. The director is not assigning any task. And in terms of now rating, how is that person going to be rated? Because no tasks are being assigned to her or to him. And the attitude, such attitude within the within government, what is our posture? Because every employee that is there, every government employee, we are expecting, if we were saying we were building a house, to put a brick so that this house can. Now, my question, I want to remind, do you have any ways and means of getting to the bones of department? Because a lot is happening. And you'll find that the department is not performing well. Because there are some people who are not assigned anything. They're sitting there because the director has got an attitude towards you. But again, in terms of the PDMS, I wanted to check, to link it with the skills audit. Isn't it not linked with skills audit as well to say, I can't perform because I end here. I can't go beyond this. But in terms of the departments, after on audit outcomes, what is it that you, what measures that you put down as public service? Maybe working, are there any departments that you can work with to say, well, if you've picked up that Department A is not doing well, obvious, we need to assist Department A. And how then do we assist Department A? Because for us to be here as the portfolio committee is to see all departments doing well. And if departments are doing well, that means people on the ground will get joy, will get the service that we are expecting because they are doing well. But again, to set up the performance management is sacrosanct, because you can't wage a war having not set up the troops. You should have the regiments that are going to go in that war. So the performance management for me is sacrosanct, because you are then saying who is going to do the job that lies ahead to us. Then, lastly, Chair, the DPSA as the custodian of the HRM framework should lead a change. Now, I wanted to check on this one as to how long do we envisage it to take? Because if this is prolonged, that means the service that we are expecting on the ground at this postponement committee is also halted. And And I wanted to check something over there as well to say, now, with this meshing, what happens, starting with the senior management, if there are six directors from this side, and six on the other side, I'm just making an example, who then remains? Are you looking at crafting a new organogram? Yeah, I think I'll end there. Yes.
Honorable Kibi.
Okay.
Honorable Motsipe.
Thanks, Chairperson. Yeah, I would like to ask this. Why is this PMDS not working? And why is being stopped? Will it be another mechanism to replace this policy? And if yes, how sure are you that new policy will be better than the previous? Then why don't we rectify the one that we have to intensify it, rather than starting a new thing altogether? And then the other one is, who was supposed to look after, for and after, who rated themselves above the norm while they were effective? And what was the consequences in those past years? Thanks.
Honorable Clark.
Thank you, Chairperson. It would be very interesting to see how many departments actually don't have their own policies in place, because that's quite a concerning issue when departments don't have their policies in place. I would also like to know, when we discover weaknesses in terms of our employees, is there any form of action in terms of the School of Governance to cater for any...
Honourable Tip, switch off your mic.
Sorry. If there are any programs in terms of the School of Governance to deal with upskilling employees in order to conform with what is expected of them and in terms of their standards. Then also, in the presentation, we spoke about standards across board in terms of performance bonuses. And I would like to know whether those standards have now been put in place, because I think, you know, I've seen it over the years, not just being in politics, but also being an official for 15 years, that there's a huge contradiction in terms of between departments when it comes to performance bonuses. And sometimes employees that really do well don't get those bonuses, and those that don't do well do. So if we could look at, if I could have that answer. And then in terms of the minister said that we heard today that the minister is going to be phasing out monetary systems in terms of performance bonuses, and I welcome that, Minister. I think that's a good move. Could you, you know, when will that start, when would that be happening? In terms of time frames, and it would be interesting to know what effect that would have in terms of the reconfiguration of national government and the financial impact that it would show. And then I am really concerned when I look at this report where departments actually spend their budgets in full, but the KPIs are very low in reaching, you know, 41% where your budget's been spent. And certain departments here, yes, still pay performance bonuses for that kind of performance, and I think that's something that we urgently need to deal with. Thank you.
Honourable Shaba.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you for the presentation, and good morning to the Minister and the team here. A lot of what my colleagues said there are similar things that I had in mind. I think from the first question, I also just wondered the ratios that you showed in terms of PMDS officials versus staff. What is a recommended ratio, if there is such a thing? Then on the question of the performance bonuses, I think we need a little bit more clarity on exactly what that entails, whether the minister wants to respond to that or someone else is fine. But it sounds like the hypothesis is that by phasing out the financial incentive, you are taking away the incentive for officials to lie and cheat on their scores. Because if it's not linked to higher bonuses, then perhaps you have an incentive to be more straightforward or honest or whatever the word may be there. I wonder if there's something else that they would replace it with. Is there a different incentive perhaps than a financial incentive? Will people still be interested in utilizing the system if there is no financial reward? Is there some kind of social reward? Is there something within the organization that makes people care about this? My third point is, I think it was also what Honorable Clark said regarding standardization. You've got these differences between departments. How standardized is this? Do people actually get assessed? Obviously, the content of the work differs from one department to the other. Do we have a way of making sure that there's something standard in place when we are assessing people? I would just echo, as a fourth point, the concern about an entire budget being spent but targets not being met. That really is very concerning. Whether performance bonuses are paid or not, that's something that goes actually beyond just that issue. And then my final question or point would be, surely it is illegal when someone manipulates the system for favoritism or in order to get a financial reward. I mean, that sounds like blatant illegality essentially. But then we talk about in the presentation about the lack of consequence management, which is, you know, it's just something that's across South African society. And frankly, lawlessness and, you know, the anarchy that we are seeing is a result of lack of consequence management writ large across society. My question is, and I think I'm going to annoy the Public Service Commission with this every time, who is supposed to implement these recommendations? You mentioned that you have presented it to the department, but frankly, it's no longer good enough to say that it's been presented to someone and it's someone else's problem, or somewhere in a back room, someone will decide which recommendations will be implemented. And I'm speaking as a member of this committee, it applies to us as well. I've made this point before, that we have a role in making sure that these recommendations are actually followed through. But when the PEC says that it will continue to monitor the rollout of the new system, the department will consider findings and recommendations, it frankly feels weak, watered down, no consequence management, perhaps as a result of the fact that we don't know who exactly is responsible for making sure that there's tough and firm action taken, not only on this report, but in all the work that the Public Service Commission does. So a response to that, I think, would be helpful. Thank you, Chair.
Honorable Malatsi.
Thanks, Chair. Just on the last point that my colleague made, can we get a sense of, post the submission of this report with the recommendations, what role then does the PSC play in making sure that there is proper tracking of the implementation of the recommendations, so that once again we can get a sense that there is value in the work that has been put in compiling the recommendations and the study, but also that it filters through to implementation, because these studies are done to improve performance where there are weaknesses and shortages, because there is this sense around studies and reports that are being done to improve performance, that once the body that's been assigned to do the work, it gets submitted, they've done their work, and then it ends there. And then the execution lies with the body which has been found to not been doing their work. Therefore, we never get to see the results, or if any, of the intention of what the scope of the study was. And secondly, to check from the commission whether in assessing these various departments, the six departments that have been chosen, whether they've been able to get closer to establishing whether the absence of performance agreements for members of the executive in the respective departments correlates with the absence of consistencies in those departments in measuring what the performance outcomes were and in relation to the payment of incentives. And lastly, to check the point as to whether in the payment or non-payment of these incentives, there's been compliance with the austerity measures that have consistently in the last three financial years been emphasized into government that, you know, there needs to be far more austere spending in government, and whether this also filters through in terms of the reward of performance incentives, particularly given that they've raised issues where they find that sometimes the reliability of the information is questionable given the lack of consistencies around scores and the compilation of those reports. Thanks, Chair.
Honourable Maneri.
Thanks, Chair. Let me also welcome the report. Maybe just to say that a number of points on the controls have been raised, because indeed would need to know consequences, especially for situations where there could have been possible loss of funds in a way where people would have unduly received bonuses when they were not supposed to, based on overrating and so on. But also, more importantly, the protection of those that perform. And because of impunity on the side of those that may be their supervisors, would still keep themselves at a lower level. But I think what also needs to be looked at is whether a developmental state would continue to look purely at audit outcomes as a way of incentivizing people for performance. Because what tends to happen is that, yes, you may have receipts and everything to prove what you've done, but the impact on the ground would be something else. And unfortunately, that's how people would look at it, is that it's an unqualified report with no findings. But if you look at the targets that were set, you have not met the targets. I think that's something to really look at there, because I've looked at the departments that you sampled. I think for me, quite a good sampling, because that's in the main your service delivery departments, and where most problems are, if I were to put it in that way, from a point of first contact by a citizen on the ground. So I'm just saying, maybe something there to explain, because as I listened to your presentation, there was emphasis about unqualified, yes, this, yes, that, because we may incentivize non-performance, actually, only to find that we work very hard to satisfy the auditor at the end of a financial transaction, but in terms of value for money, have we delivered what we said we'd deliver? Becomes, I think, a problem. Of course, you can see it on percentages. Usually the expectation would be that if I've put R1, at least the impact should be more than the rand, because I would have tried to stretch. So maybe that point is more emphasized. But just to maybe the last point for now, Chair, would be on the part where there's an issue about capacity. And indeed, I'm trying to imagine that because you are HR department, you must know it all. And that some departments get to be quite technical. I'm just trying to look at how you align the part that's being raised in the report. Besides the training that needs to happen, have you also considered, because I couldn't see that in the recommendations, I may have rushed over them, whether you've considered, especially in such departments, multidisciplinary teams as opposed to just your HR, so that you also don't make an HR specialist to evaluate an engineer, if you get what I'm saying. Whereas you stand to benefit from multidisciplinary teams that can be drawn from the same. Right? But again, to also try and deal with a sense of objectivity as these reports are evaluated at another level. So those were the questions I needed to ask. Thanks, Chair.
Honorable Lesomo.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. Good morning, colleagues and Minister. My apology for arriving late. I had just a back-to-back meeting this morning. My apology. Having said that, probably let me welcome the presentation by Public Service Commission with an understanding that in terms of your act, it does allow you to also to have an engagement with the EAs. With those ones with the red, have you had any or requested an audience with the with the EAs, and what were their response? Because it's not an issue of this financial year, which is 2018-19 as it were. So for me, and let me qualify why I'm making that statement, because if then the AG's report in terms of the overall performance of the department says that we have regressed, then it says a lot. Maybe then the issue is with the EAs and the DGs. But also I must say that probably the minister might assist on this one. The overflow of the work that comes from Public Service Commission to DPSA and DPSA's relationship with DPME in terms of the DGs in particular, because they are the ones that evaluate DGs. But in terms of the below part of it. Then my question would be, what is the relationship between those two bodies? Because I know that in terms of your act, you are empowered also, you recommend. Do your recommendations being taken seriously by the EAs? Because Honorable Minister, it talks to the delegated authority by the Minister, to the DGs, DGs to their immediate subordinates as it were. I'm happy that you are also intending to phase out the performance bonus, because they were meant for the officials to perform more than what they are expected. Because you can't congratulate and award the fish for swimming just because it's the fish and it swims. I do have a serious problem if that was the attitude. Although then, again, moving forward, we'll monitor then what would be the attitude of DPSA in terms of that. Chairperson, the other one that I would like to probably to link with the suggestion that I made last week, which the committee also supported, that probably we need also, when we are calling those departments the serious offenders on what we discussed last week, that we call these departments that are non-performance. But the other ones, because I understand that you were doing like a snapshot in terms of assessing the behavior of government departments, as it were, that we also invite, Honorable Chair, Public Works and Water and Sanitation. Precisely, I'll tell you why. Public Works had outsourced its core mandate, but it still failed to perform its core mandate, as it were. Secondly, in terms of water department as well, better not to comment on that one. But I'm suggesting that let's invite them. Because it questions and borders on our role as parliamentarians to doing our oversight, whether anybody listens to us and takes us seriously. Other than that, I think we must have a dedicated day, if you're looking for a better way, for the DGs, because they're there to stay, by the way, at the department. The minister could be new, but the DGs, they have been there. And we've been fair enough to them to say, no, we're a caring government, we'll keep you. Notwithstanding that in 5 years they have never been performing, but you walk tall that you are a DG. Thank you, Chair.
Commission?
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Thank you, members, for the questions. I will respond as quickly as I can. And then, with your permission, there are certain questions that I would refer to Mr. Dibe here, who's our DDG in the Public Service Commission. First of all, starting with Honorable Ntuli's question, I think the issue of the selection of the six departments, Honorable Ntuli, yes, I think Honorable Manelli started pointing towards that. These are critical service delivery departments, but also some of the departments that are dealing with matters that are not just critical in terms of, let's say, we normally think education and health, but there are certain priorities as well that have been set for the country. We know the issue of water and sanitation, really the issue of human settlement and so on. So this basically based on those criteria that we looked. And of course there are perceptions about these departments with regards to how well or how poorly they are performing, and that's why we selected those departments. The issue of the ratios, what they should be, and all of the questions that related to that, also from Honorable Scheiber, I think I will ask Mr. Dibe to just respond to that. The Honorable Ntuli spoke about the issue of favoritism and in cases where we find that there are people who are working in a public service but they are not working. And it's a combination, Honorable Member, of yes, I completely agree. If a person is sidelined or victimized, we want to call it in that way, where a person is not allowed to do productive work, you are completely right. How do you assess such a person? You can't assess such a person because that person has not been assigned work. We don't even know whether such a person, there would obviously be a job description because that person is in a position. But if the person is not given any work because of vindictiveness or victimization by a specific senior, then it means that that kind of behavior will really filter down even to the level where you are not able to realistically assess the performance of such a person because the person is not allowed. Such a person, of course, would have recourse to lodge a grievance because it does really mean that that person is being victimized. This person is not being used productively in the system. And rightfully, as you said, will not be able to assess that person. The PMDS links to issues of the skills audit. It starts with recruitment. When you go through the recruitment process, obviously there would have been an advertisement in the newspaper that says we want such and such a person, and this person must meet a specific criteria. And that is where we are saying to the departments must stick to the criteria that they've put out in their advertisement because you want to attract a specific skill. Be that as it may, when a person is in a specific position and the department has through their performance assessment process identified certain weaknesses, yes, then that person needs to be upskilled. It is the responsibility of the department to, in the personal development plan for such a person, make sure that the person then gets the necessary training. How do we assist departments as the Public Service Commission on the PMDS system in relation to the grievances that we got relating to the incorrect application of the PMDS system? We've had several workshops. We point out what are the things that are lacking to the oversight body, especially as you've mentioned, the custodian of the PMDS system is the Department of Public Service and Administration, and we are in discussion with them. We report to the portfolio committee to indicate this is where the systems are working or not working, and as Honorable Lesoma has also indicated, when we bring specific matters here and the portfolio committee decides to intervene or to hold the departments or the EAs responsible, it's also a way of reinforcing the work that we are doing as a Public Service Commission because we are reporting to Parliament. How long is the process, the change management process, going to take in specific relation to the PMDS system? What is currently being planned? I think the people best to answer that question should be DPSA. The DG is here, and he may want to outline some of the things that they are still envisaging in the current process that they are engaged with. The question with regards to if there are six directors, with the amalgamation of the department. I think, Honorable Ntuli, that specific question, because it links to the reconfiguration of the state, I will also then ask DPSA to maybe just briefly, I'm sure the DG will respond to that matter with relation to the amalgamation of specific departments. Honorable Motsepe, on the issue of why the system is not working, I think in terms of the recommendations that we are making, we would have pointed out where the gaps are, where the weaknesses are, and it is in relation to that we would then have a discussion with DPSA to say, look, if the policy says, I'm just making an example, for example, if the policy does not allow a moderation committee to reduce the individual scores of a person without referring the matter back. So let's say, for example, between myself and my supervisor, we have agreed or we have caucused even to say, now I must get a 4 or I must get a 5. And then that evidence must go to the moderation committee. Now the moderation committee is not convinced that I must be getting a 5. Then they can't just decide, no, they must reduce my score. There is a process through which they have to refer the whole matter back. They will have to say to the employee and the supervisor, sorry, we are not convinced. We have not provided sufficient evidence. So these are some of the problems that we say which are occurring, where departments in some cases are not following correct processes. And we are encouraging them to say no, but the policy says this, and this is how you have to do it. So in some cases, it's because the officials are not implementing the policy as intended, and in a few cases, it means that the policy itself has to be amended. So on all of the issues where we believe that there should be a policy amendment, those are the issues that we will refer to DPSA to say this aspect of the policy is not working so nicely, and we will ask them to consider reviewing it, and they would then do that. And certainly, as you indicated, this is not a new policy from scratch. This is exactly why we are saying there is a policy, these parts are not working, these parts are working, and when we are saying DPSA has implemented a new system, we are not meaning scratching everything off the old. We are saying that they are trying to improve on some of the inadequacies that have been pointed out. Honorable Clark, how many departments don't have policies in place? Yes, there could be several departments who do not have their own internal policies in place, but what we must remember is that there is an overarching policy of which DPSA is the custodian. So whatever departments decide to do internally, they cannot step outside of the broader framework of the policy as determined by DPSA to ensure that there's uniformity across the system. But there may be slight deviations here and there. Some departments where they don't have their internal policy, they will just say to us, no, but we don't think we need a policy. We are doing everything according to the overarching policy. In terms of poor management, certainly, I must say the DG of DPSA is here today. He knows. He's been the DG of the Public Service Commission as well as DPSA as well as NSG. So he may be able to reflect on what programs there are. We do know that there are programs in place at the National School of Government during which they empower public servants. There's a whole range of programs that target specific areas of weaknesses. So it may also not be perfect the way we want it. There may be certain areas that are not specifically covered, but we do believe that there are a number of courses that officials in the public service can go into outlining specific areas in which there may be deficiencies in their performance. The standards that are in place, I think Honorable Scheiber also asked questions with regards to targets that specific standards that should be in place, so that if, for example, a person is supposed to score a 4, then everyone must understand that this is what it means to be getting a 4. And certainly, those standards are there in place. It is part of the descriptors in the performance assessment framework. However, we do believe that even with those descriptors, you know, people would still want to interpret it in their own way. If we for example would say, but for you to get a 5, you must have performed over and above the target that you have set for yourself. But then there are other complexities that come in. You will find that the target that people have set is so low that it's so easy for them to meet that target. So it's easy for them then to overachieve and award themselves a 5. And unfortunately, those things, in as far as systems go, it's challenges not just that we are faced with as this country. It's challenges across the board, I would say, whenever you measure performance, how do you make sure that the system is as objective as you possibly can make it? But certainly, there are certain targets where descriptors are in place for performing at a specific level. I think on the issue of phasing out and what gets what is in place of the money incentives, I will ask Kolofelo to speak to that, but certainly DPSA would also be at liberty to comment on that. I'm hoping that I have, that was the first question of Honourable Scheiber, also in terms of if this is taken out, what does it get replaced with, the issue of standardization. The issue of the budget that is spent and targets not met, it's been raised also by other members, and certainly that is our concern, because if you have met, if you have spent almost all of your money and you have not reached all of your targets, what has gone wrong in that system? Does it mean again that in these departments they have set targets which are unachievable, unrealistic? Or does it actually just mean that they've spent the money and they haven't delivered anything? So those are the complexities in the system that one would have to look at. I must also say, part of how the Auditor General has managed the auditing process in this country, you will know that there's what they called at the time incremental auditing. Right at the beginning, when they started, they would audit financial performance. For example, have you followed the rules? Have you implemented the PFMA correctly? And so it became a kind of a mechanical thing, because if the only thing that you check is, did they follow the supply chain process? Did they ask for 3 quotes? Did they do this? Did they do that? And did they pay the people? But then the question of, but did they get value for money, is something that was added later on. When the Auditor General started their process, they did not audit performance, but they now in the process of auditing performance. So it's also how our systems begin to mature and how we begin to find out that where there is a loophole, people find the loophole and they'll try and jump through that loophole. And that is why there was this kind of thing that developed, that you would find departments spending their money, spending it perfectly. But yet, when you look at how many houses were built, how many toilets, how many whatever they had to do, then you find, but there is a problem there. So I remember there was a time that we even said you can get an unqualified audit without necessarily having delivered. And I think the system is really trying to begin to address these kinds of challenges. The issue of consequence management, who has to implement our recommendations, and what if our recommendations are not implemented. I think, as I've said also, yes, the PSC, we engage with departments, we engage with EAs, we will bring our findings to EAs, we will, on. I think what we need to understand is that in the Constitution, in our specific mandate, there are certain matters on which we have to make recommendations. But those recommendations will be made to departments, and certainly we are challenging ourselves at the moment to say, okay, so should we also pathetically sit back and just say we've made recommendations, but nobody is listening to us, and sit on the side like crybabies, or should we begin to really have a different approach to actually ensure that there is a higher level of uptake on our recommendations. So we are in the process of sorting out our own system. We have been requested in the past by EAs by premiers, former members of the portfolio committee, to bring to this committee and to legislatures the recommendations of the PSC that have not been implemented, in order for them also to bring the departments to book and to ask them for reasons why they have not implemented the recommendations of the PSC. Certainly, we also have to be far more robust, because the reality is, if a recommendation is not implemented, do we just sit back and say, oh, sorry, they have not implemented, or do we push forward to say, we're demanding reasons for why you have not implemented our recommendations? So, yes, we are challenged in that regard, and we are also heartened by the fact that oversight bodies like this portfolio committee and, of course, legislatures and parliament is willing to reinforce the fact that departments should really listen to what constitutional bodies like ourselves are saying. And then, Honorable Malatsi, I think, asked a similar question, posed as recommendations, what should then be done. As I said, our reports come to Parliament, to this portfolio committee. There was a question regarding to whether our issue of performance agreements for departments and officials and heads of departments, whether there is a link with the performance agreements for EAs. And I must say that no, we are not dealing with performance agreements of EAs. As you know, those agreements get entered into at a different level. So whether it's the president that must hold ministers to account or the premier that must hold MECs to account, that process is clear. We are not really dealing with that. The issue of whether there's compliance with austerity measures, at the moment there is a fixed percentage what is allowed for departments to spend on incentive rewards, and they are not allowed to go over that. Of course, they can be under that, but the challenge generally is for them to stay within that margin. I think Honorable Manelli spoke about the issue of controls and consequence management, and also how to protect those who perform, whether if they have performed, how do we make sure that they are not being victimized? And really, Honorable Member, if there is a grievance that comes from an employee that says, actually, I was supposed to perform at this level, and we do get some of those grievances where an employee will come to us and say, there's agreement between myself and my supervisor that this is what I am worth in the system, and we would then follow through on that grievance, and we would normally send that process back to be re-evaluated by the department. And there have been instances where we have indicated to departments that they have victimized specific individuals, and that these individuals, in fact, through the evidence that they have produced, they are entitled to be rewarded. But I do think the current solution to find other ways of incentivizing people, to find ways of delinking the issue of performance awards, will also from the issue of money, will begin to solve some of these problems in the system. I think you did make the point that surely we should not just look at audit outcomes, and surely we should look at other ways of rewarding good performance and good behavior. And I think I'm going to ask a fellow here just to also reflect on the issue of multidisciplinary teams, because yes, there are certain areas where you can't have people who are only responsible for HR sitting on a process that will evaluate the performance of a specialist person. I think the system is still in the process of evolving, and we certainly have to keep on pointing out to the challenges that there are in the system of performance management and development with the view of making it better. On Honorable Lesoma's question, I think I hopefully have answered part of that. How do we engage with EAs? How do we engage with DGs? How do we engage with departments generally? And the fact that we are allowed to engage with EAs.
Can I just, it was more of a statement, okay, which then should be taken by the minister. Because in terms of the act, it does say that you can have a meeting, but it seems like you are not getting any returns on that. And then you were right when we said that this portfolio committee must take over, but it was not necessarily a question.
Thank you, Honourable Member. Yes, thank you for that. And certainly we agree with you on some of the matters that you have also proposed to invite Public Works and to have your own initiatives whereby hopefully you'll be able to engage with DGs, with EAs on the matters that we as the PSC bring to you. With your permission, Chair, if it's okay, then I just want Kolofelo to respond to the issues of ratio. I think there's two issues that she has to respond to, if it's fine with you. Thank you, Chair.
Why you can respond, Kolofelo?
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson and members. I would like to address the issue of the HR capacity, the ratios, and the multidisciplinary teams in one, because they are interlinked. As the PSC, we do not necessarily have a prescribed ratio for the size of HR versus the numbers of employees they need to oversee. However, we are of the view that currently there is evidence that our HR components, to a greater degree, even those who have been in certain departments for long, they do not have the technical expertise to even understand the mandates of their departments. Their ability to advise branches and senior managers on the contents of their PAs therefore gets limited to process issues, but not the interrogation of the PAs in relation to the APP and the medium-term strategic framework. So that is the one aspect that we say HR employees really need to be capacitated so that they begin to play a strategic role, not a process and administrative role, which has been the historic function of HR. The other aspect of capacity really relates to senior managers or the technical experts themselves. As long as they do not have the right attitude towards the PMDS, HR will not get it right, whether you increase its capacity or you capacitate them to understand the technical mandates of the departments that they are serving. The setting of performance standards and other issues at the technical level should be driven by senior managers, DGs, DDGs, directors, and so forth, including your middle managers at the level of deputy director. And hence, the recommendation on there is a need to ensure that the implementation of the revised policy is accompanied with a training. On the issue of the multidisciplinary team, the new PMDS system makes it mandatory for departments to moderate performance agreements so that you don't come and deal with a poorly crafted PA whilst you are reviewing a person after 12 months. As the PSC ourselves, we have gone through a rigorous system ourselves to see how it will work. It is time consuming. However, the return on the moderation of the PAs will give you the results that you're looking for. It is one of the messages when we had a debriefing with the Deputy Minister last week, we did indicate that it is important for DPSA to make sure that the departments do implement the system of moderating performance agreements, and those moderation committees comprises of senior managers from all the branches of a department, including your HR. So the multidisciplinarity will already be taken care of. And if it is done well, a lot of the challenges that I experienced at the end and the over-allocation or under-allocation of work to different employees can be picked up right at the beginning of the financial year. I think with that, I think I've addressed the three issues. Thank you.
There was a question in respect of amalgamation of departments. I would prefer that the DG must not answer that question now, but as the department is presenting, you must touch on this question. Yeah. Thank you very much, Minister.
I'm working on the assumption that in the discussion certain things have moved our direction, and my early indication that we wanted to give PSC a full grounds to play, and then just make comments at the end.
Okay.
Now, firstly, I want to say that at DBSA as a department, we are always grateful for the work that the PSC do. And we as MPS as the other minister for public service generally, we have to always encourage them that they move the direction that they are taking in terms of ensuring that our systems in public service do work. The enforceability, if there's such a thing in the English language, to me is not a very it's not something that I have a problem of sleeping thinking about it. Because the day you say you must govern the world only via authority, prescribed authority, in order to get what humanity needs in the whole world, it will be its own destruction at the same time. I think we... although the system all over the world, particularly the private sector, is much more stronger on those and make our lives in the public service very hard in terms of competing, using the vulnerability of a human being to get more and more, even in that situation, I think we have to try and be very cautious about moving on in that direction of saying public service or the Public Service Commission as it stands, it doesn't have authority to implement and therefore it's undermined and therefore it's... I don't think we should move to that direction and put ourselves into a corner. It makes a whole difference to say this is right, this is wrong. Even if you don't have power to enforce what is right, but that moral power, that strong moral high ground on which you stand to say this is right, this is wrong, is powerful enough. Of course, provided DAs are going to understand and play their role and take everything further. So I just wanted to indicate that. But let's go on to just deal with a few other things that came. The PMDS is... quite a plausible system, and I think that's why we say we appreciate the work that they've done in order to check whether it is effective and so on. I'm happy, we're happy with all the findings and so on. For now, humanity and us in the DPSA need to always explore innovatively whether there's something better that can come, not necessarily by way of replacement. If that comes, let it come, but at the moment that's not the issue, that you want to replace, you want to strengthen you want to make sure it's effective, you want to move to a system, to a situation where it gives you efficiency that you require, more than being frustrated by saying you want to replace it because it's ineffective, as the finding does say. So we'll always be in search for new factors, whether they are within or outside the system. If they are, if those factors become dominant, then that will be the time to replace the existing system, PMTS. Of course, as you say, in as the report says, it does constrain, because it's a system, it requires some people to monitor and so on. So it does cause a constraint in terms of warm bodies and hours. So imposing some unnecessary limitations to actually getting the system fully implemented. But we'll play along and see how the recommendations of strengthening it, even taking on board that factor, how we do it. The human factor issue, it's a problem, subjectivity. Here is a system, it tells you to do this, and then you want to use it for other things. That one will always, you use the system just to get money, or just to promote your friend, or that's not the intention. But it's vulnerable to that, and we have to always come up with new innovations to limit that particular side of it, which is not intended. Let me just talk about bonuses for clarity, that issue. All the statements here are welcome, but just to say, these statements that we've made in the past, we are not necessarily wanting to change them, as long as we just add one phrase that says subject to conclusive discussion with labor. Now, it's not a new thing, and I'm sure members are very clear that when the statement was made in February, it was made within the executive rights that the executive has in the form of the Minister of Finance. He has a right to make those statements in terms of what he sees, where he sits, and followed by all of us. But just note that we have to go through labor discussions, which are in place in earnest, where we clarify ourselves in terms of what is it that is behind this thinking and the pronouncement of such a statement. And we've agreed with labor that such a session is very necessary. And for now, we've identified the 20th of September, where government and labor sits down, and we explain ourselves in terms of all the issues. We're going to look for all the issues that might affect relations between government and labor, not in fact in the sense of making them that space a fighting zone, but just to understand each other, to say, in these 5 years of the sixth administration, there's going to be this and this and this and this and this. Let's prepare ourselves. And then we say, in the light of all these things that we've outlined, what are the possible solutions? How do we navigate ourselves, the whole ship of public service and labor, to move forward in the interest of South Africa as a whole? Because I've no doubt in our earlier discussions with labor, everybody agrees that we want to get there. There's no wide difference is there from what I've experienced. All of us agree we need to get there. And everybody wants to move from where we are. And that to me is a very powerful tool. When people say, no, let's move from where we are. Because if we sit here for a long time, this thing is likely to sink us. Then the next question, where do we go? There's nobody who's pointing this way. Everybody's pointing forward. Let's go forward. All of us, government and labor. What we have to navigate, and it's just the way to get there. And that's what we're beginning to do on the 20th. And that will include implementation of this or talks about this matter of bonuses to explain ourselves where we come from with this. And then look at it in terms of its impact in affecting conditions of service. But then how do all of us get all of us to move towards that direction? So it's not change that I'm saying, but it's an issue that we have to make public pronouncements with caution and subject to those conclusive discussions with labor, which I'm saying are undergoing. Well, that honourable member issue that you mentioned, DME and DPSA, as far as teachers are concerned, is an issue that we need to resolve once and for all very quickly. If you say there's something called DPSA, which deals with public service, let it deal with public service from entry up to exit. Let there be one authority. Don't bring in too many authorities, because you are splitting and killing the center if you do so. We'll have a discussion with our colleagues in DPME. I do understand that at some point, 2017, Cabinet took a resolution in terms of how to evaluate and assess DGs, because seemingly they have had space that is less regulated and so on in terms of performance and so on. But I'm not saying that they haven't been performing, but we all have to work under a strain. If ministers can be binded to, not that they don't have, they have, but we'll move to that space. The issue of incentive. If you get to a dispensation where you rely lesser and lesser on monetary remuneration as an incentive for higher performance, what then replaces that? There's no conclusive discussion on that, but instead of focusing on that, it has led us to look at other things. One of these things is to say, that question, why do you pay bonus for somebody whose leadership has produced adverse audit outcomes, like wasteful expenditure? We've had a meeting with the Auditor General to say, what is the meaning of wasteful expenditure? Beyond just what we read as a sentence. We say, can you turn that thing into rands and cents? What would it actually mean? If you talk about irregular expenditure, what's that? Now, is it justifiable to pay somebody a bonus when there has been irregular expenditure, wasteful expenditure? Is it fair to the public? But not only that, we've also moved to say, what is the state of affairs as far as litigations are concerned? And we've seen that they constitute quite a leak in the fiscus.
to a point where we have established a team of officials that are at work at the moment, just few departments, to say no. When the Auditor General says wasteful expenditure, what must be the consequence? Must we just say, yeah, hey, wasteful expenditure? Take an action that says keep it up. So what's the consequence? I don't think that we should be the only ones in that question. I think the legislature itself, because my understanding is that it will be part of my oversight. If you yourselves in the legislature promote a situation where there's no consequence for wasteful expenditure, no consequence for irregular expenditure, you are making the Auditor General useless or even less useful, and they are going to complain and say, really, what's our role, because our findings mean nothing. So I think we need to freshen up, all of us, and make the system bite and make the system work without necessarily relying on saying, what does the minister do? We're going to make him or her accountable when we ourselves in terms of our mandate. So I think we are waking up to that, to say, let's make the system work with the authority that we have. And therefore, we're beginning to ask. So essentially coming back to say, incentives will always be plenty. If you enter any system in any organization, one day you hope you'll be promoted to a better position. And then one other day to another, one other day to another. And as this thing happens, you are growing yourself. And as you grow, you reach a stage where you are less enthusiastic about more and more positions. You look sideways. So it's not like you are ever looking for promotion until you retire. You reach satisfactory levels at some point. But let's talk. If you are born in South Africa and you happen to enter public service at 25 or so, it's an incentive to get to a position where you work for your nation, just like every other person anywhere in the world. Whatever you get offered by your country to say service the country via public service, it's an incentive. You get promoted, you get promoted. So I think we need to move towards that, and lesser on the dependence on monetary. Yes, that must come in a particular way, but let's not push ourselves up to that. I would for now say, and the last thing, even if with an improved PMDS, we will not replace basic or remove basic traditional methods of saying, if we were working as a group and he is the supervisor, his job is to be physically here, system or no system, be here. If work has to start at 7, he has to use his eyes to see if everybody did enter the door at 7 and they start working and they are not in. So those traditional methods can't just be replaced. Whatever we have in terms of technology, it must complement and take us to higher heights. And so we're not going to focus on that and say we just have to do our work and move on. Those are the comments I wanted to make.
Thank you. And now the DG must present. I'm giving you the floor to do that.
Sorry, Chair. You want me to make the presentation, or do you want me to make some responses to the discussion?
Well, if there are questions in the discussions that were not adequately answered, you can answer those, but thereafter, give us that presentation. Yeah.
Okay, perhaps I could just make a few remarks in terms of the challenge of coming up with a system which would make us sit around this table and think, well, now we've got a better system. I think what the minister said is that if you serve in the public service, you're serving the nation. And I think it's very important that the organizational culture of public service is a public interest one. That employees get a proper balance between serving the nation through their department and serving their own personal interests. And that has to really, that's the missing element for me, having seen this whole thing and the way it operates, is the need to, even in your measurement systems, have ways of determining how an individual contributes to a unit and ultimately to the department as an organization and ultimately to the national endeavor. And obviously the metrics will differ if you're at the top of DG, and as you go down the metrics will be more internally focused. And I think that is really the big challenge we have in these systems. So I think in different words, the minister was saying that organizational culture is very important, and even from the side of the commission. And that's really one of the big challenges we have in the public service. So the Honourable Ntuli did pose a question about certain individuals who find themselves marginalised, they ignored, they mistreated or whatever in the workplace. And I think one of the big jobs that needs to be done, and hence one of the Minister's priorities on Batho Pele, is really to try and shift the organisational culture of the public service, and that would need to be reflected, amongst other things, in the framework of the PMDS, which, as the Commission pointed out very clearly, is a framework, and each department must use that framework to come up with its own special system. I do think one of the important issues that came up is the whole issue of how the evaluation panels do their work. And within those evaluation panels, whether it's for assessing performance right up to the top level or appointing people, how do they bring in technical expertise which can help them to assess whether or not people are performing, whether or not people are competent for the job? I think it's a missing dimension in the discussion. It's not only about objectivity and have a system that is objective, it's about really looking into the specialist skills and outcomes that are required. I think in the search for excellence, because when we discuss PMDS, we're searching for excellence. How do we get excellence in public service? The question is how to measure it. And I think that's what we're grappling with in the public service in South Africa, but globally. How do you distinguish between measuring an input and an output and measuring an outcome and ultimately an impact? And how often can you measure an impact? You can't measure an impact every day. You can't measure it every quarter. You can't manage it measure it every year. You really need to get a significant stretch of time before you can see that you have a real impact. So, and then, you know, the issue is that PMDS is treated as a human resource management practice. But I think, as the minister is saying, it's also an important condition of service. And to get that balance right, I think is one of the challenges at the moment. But I think I have made a few comments, Honourable Chair, and I'm not sure if we need to introduce the presentation, but I'll be ready. Yeah, thank you.
Okay.
Now, just before you deal with your presentation, I think the minister must, before that, give us an overview of what is going to come before us.
Thank you, very Chair. Briefly, we are grateful for this opportunity to present to the members of the portfolio committee so that we take each other on board and in confidence on all the matters pertaining to to NMOC. But of course, the first point that I want to point out is we will once more contextualize this in terms of the mindset that we are in as South Africans, led by the president, in terms of moving towards a developmental state and all its prescripts, from size to role and effectiveness to efficiency issues generally as the state. And in the context, compare ourselves with other governments and countries in the world in comparable circumstances. So we'll contextualize that. But the second point that I want to make is that we do, while driving this process, we have references to other years when there were changes in terms of the size of government and direction of government. Even within a broader situation that says that, yes, there was broadening of government at some point, and now we are moving back, and so on. But there are new lessons and new things that are developing that we have to learn. And we're playing our role as public service, not competing with the president, but just saying maybe in the context of the directions that we have given, there could be much more to gain if we went this far, that far, that far. And we're going to be doing that for the whole of the 5 years and so on, just making proposals on what, in terms of implementing his prescripts. The third point is that there are many things to explain here in terms of where we are, how we are doing it in terms of structures, and where we are. But my emphasis to officials has been to say, with the Director General in the Office of the President, and via our DG, let's drive a process that delivers, as opposed to driving a process that will deliver at the end. I've made an example of a bus. If you ride on a bus from Cape Town to Joburg, once people are in, you say, let's close the door and windows, and then we'll deliver everything, your coughing, your everything, once we reach Joburg. I'm saying let's not use that model. As we move from Cape Town, if there's someone who wants to leave, let's open the door. Those leave, if there are people who must come in, let them come in. So the bus must deliver the goods. In other words, as we drive NMOC as a system, we must remember that we have government at work. And therefore, it must deliver on the need to have a functional government right now, not in December when everything is looked at the end. So that those are the things that we're trying to match, we're trying to make the system work. And what we find, which is the last thing, is the other related matters, what happens when suddenly, as a result of the change of government, you have extra people that you can't accommodate, and how do you conduct that with labor so that you have understanding and so on. So these are all the matters that the DG will touch on, and I'll add if there's any gap.
Over to you, DG.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chairperson, Honourable Members, Minister. The presentation is kind of organised around the context which the Minister has spoken to as well. The lessons learnt from previous process of reorganising government, the issue of national executives and departments, in other words, just not going line by line, but saying this is what the reconfiguration actually means in practice in terms of how departments have moved or merged, come under a single minister and so on. The outcomes, the instruments of the responsible departments, to undertake some analysis and then to just look at the practical way in which the process is being managed and comment on the progress. So to share with you the actual timelines that have been set for the various actions which are required to reorganize and reconfigure government. So obviously, as the ministers indicated, we want to create value with public funds. And we want to create a public-private interface that raises employment and growth. And the vision of the National Development Plan, as well as the sixth administration, cannot really be achieved in the absence of good governance. So the current challenge for public administration and therein the public service is around delivering more and better with less. I think we all understand the current economic constraints. We need to meet societal needs. We need to meet the needs of the people in terms of Section 195 of the Constitution in times of tighter budgets. We need to adapt service provision to demographic, technological, and society changes, and improve the business or economic climate through fewer and smarter regulations and better services in support of growth and competitiveness. So I think the issue of red tape is present in the business world as much as it is present in the public service world. And those are things we would need to also address going forward. I think the experience of the last 2.5 decades have shown that different administrative reforms and paths and results require capacity, they require sustainability of the approach, as well as the maturity around implementation. The fiscal crisis obviously has reinforced the relevance of public administration, which includes the configuration of government, its size, its outcomes, its results. And the administrative culture is very important in terms of determining the operationalization of these principles. So really, Section 195 of the Constitution, the values and principles of public administration, and Batu Pele must drive the culture of the administration in South Africa. We do also need to invest in the capabilities of public servants in order to design better quality of policies and services. And in doing all of this, we are informed by, as the Minister has indicated, the National Development Plan's commitment to building a capable developmental state. Now, if we look at the successful developmental states in East Asia, they demonstrate very, very strong human capabilities, and they were built brick by brick, institution by institution, and they were sustained and rejuvenated over time. They developed the art of partnerships and how to embed themselves in society in order to meet people's needs. So the relationship between the government and the people, the state and the people, is critical in terms of how you refashion or redesign the state. So the President has pronounced on several occasions that growth, development, and transformation depend on a strong and capable state. And that's why he embarked on this initiative from his initial inauguration up until the present. And there has been a process since that time of reviewing the configuration, the number and size of national departments. And there has been a task team within the presidency which has taken inputs from a wide variety of players across society in coming up with the determination. So I think there is the issue of bloatedness, which often has come up. And I think it's in the number of ministries that had evolved over time, and there will be a table in the presentation which clearly indicates from the Mandela administration the change in the number of ministries over the 25 years. But if we just look at these countries we've named here, from Namibia to Zimbabwe to Tanzania, we've seen that if we benchmark ourselves, we should be looking at a size roughly between 22 and 28. And for the three first administrations, that indeed was the size. There was a large expansion, and now there is a contraction in the size of, in the number of ministries, and that we will go through here. Some departments perform mandates that should be performed at a program level. Now, this is obviously an issue of debate, but if we think there's a particular function or area of development which is failing, it can't necessarily be solved in a structural term. So there are debates which have been there during the whole process of coming up with the configuration. For example, small business. Do you have it separate? Well, that's what we've gone for. That's what we went for over a number of years. But there is another argument which would say there is a whole value chain, and a department like that fits within the value chain, and therefore the policy making process should not be distinct. In any case, I'm just indicating that these are some of the issues which sort of drive the debate. There is a lot of learning. We need to recognize that there was a major expansion in the fourth administration, and the DPSA, I was there as the DG at that time, we developed all the tools and instruments and processes, but there are lessons. And I think part of the lessons is the high turnover rate at the level of the executive and HODs has led to a destabilization of the public service, continuously changing, leading to policy uncertainty, etc. And as we remember from the budget speech of the minister, hence stabilizing the public service is a major priority for public service and administration during the sixth administration. but I think one of the biggest challenges which we need to present, because it's one which does sort of concern the DPSA, the National Treasury, departments at the center, is Program 1, Support Services, the program that supports departments. And I think that's where the size and the ratios are something that we would need to address going forward. We have a situation where we probably have a 70-30 ratio, and it probably is not the ideal ratio. We need to be looking at 75-25 or even 80-20. And that also raises the issues which the Honourable Ntuli referred to around what happens when you get more than one person in a post, and that is addressed later on. Really, the reorganization from the State of the Nation Address in 2018 is to enhance the performance of government, to improve the lives of citizens, grow the economy, cut wasteful expenditure, ensure greater savings, ensure that public servants are not negatively affected by the changes, ensure that the jobs of public servants remain safe, and communication with the public as the process goes forward. So really, the issue in, or the principles which drive a configuration, is how do we optimally arrange the individual executive portfolios and the way in which departments then are subordinated to that identification of individual executive portfolios. The National Development Plan, the election manifesto, the policy of the governing party of the day will also influence how the configuration takes place. So what we need to do in a configuration is look at clustering different functions to ensure that functional areas of responsibility are clearly demarcated to avoid ambiguity, overlapping, or duplication of functions. So if there was a feeling, for example, in the fourth administration that it was better to separate minerals and energy because you don't give proper attention to them if you have them in one configuration. The lesson there would maybe be that actually we created a duplication, because to drive the energy portfolio is very interdependent with the mining or minerals portfolio. So these are the kind of things that drives the process and ensure that an executive portfolio as constituted will be responsible for the broad policy outcomes and realize value for citizens. We also need to ensure that there's maximum collaboration within the government cluster system, streamlining the multiple role players for the same or similar objectives, enforcing accountability for deliverables by the executive and the public administration, make sure that the progressive realization of socioeconomic rights spelled out in Chapter 2 of the Constitution in the Bill of Rights are achieved through any reconfiguration that takes place. The optimization of resource use is also critical, containing the wage bill. It should not lead to a proliferation of spending around the wage bill. And then ensuring that the administration of legislation with the required accountability rests with one executive authority, because splitting the departments did lead to overlaps, new legislation coming. So as you will see with the configuration, it's not simply saying these are the departments. You have to go through a whole process of identifying the legislation, where it sits, and then transferring it to the new relevant authority. So these slides, I'm not necessarily going to go through them, but if you look at the columns, there's the portfolio, there's the current department, there's the new department, and there's the comments on affected departments. So we see that there's a process of merging in as much as there's a process of splitting or transferring various functions. So the first one listed, they are in alphabetical order, agriculture, land reform, and rural development. We now have one new department of agriculture, land reform, and rural development, so we're merging under one minister. In other cases, we have one minister, but the departments are not functionally merged. So one minister will oversee two departments. So if we look, for example, at the second slide here, and we see higher education, science and technology, we still see that there are two departments, that they are under one minister, so the departments themselves are not affected, as would be the case where a merger takes place. So these slides I've indicated, I'm not going to read through them because I think many of the honourable members are aware, but this does give an indication of how departments are affected in the formation of new departments. It also shows, for example, under number 17, the presidency, and it looks at the fact that certain functions from DPME were transferred to the presidency, those dealing with socioeconomic assessment. So any bill or proposed bill, there must be a socioeconomic assessment which is conducted before Cabinet will consent to introducing the bill to Parliament. And then Policy and Research Services, this was a function that existed in the Presidency, the Policy Coordination and Advisory Services in the first, second and third administrations. It was done away with, it's been recreated. I'm sort of pausing there because when we go through all the numbers here, we ultimately come to 29, but we've listed the presidency, so the number of executives is 28. And I'm just, because there may be a question, why have you got 29 when there's actually 28? I'm just explaining, we were explaining what happened in terms of the reconfiguration at the level of the presidency. At the end on slide 16, we have the departments that merge. So agriculture, land reform and rural development, communications and new technologies, which is a merger of the Department of Telecommunications and Postal Services with communications, and then mineral resources and energy I've mentioned, sports, arts and culture merge, and trade, industry and economic development merge as well. Now these are really, this is a timetable, the next few slides, which talk about the essential sort of actions which need to be taken in a reconfiguration. The appointment of ministers and deputy ministers, President's Act, it's obviously been done in May. The listing and renaming of national departments, their presidential proclamation to amend Schedule 1 of the Public Service Act, that's been done already in June. Technical corrections to the appropriation bill to create new or amend budget votes. This is something under preparation, but obviously during the MTBPS, these processes will become clearer, and then in the new financial year through the medium-term expenditure framework. The tabling of the adjustments appropriations bill, the transfer of the administration of laws between ministers. Now, this is a very important piece of work which, for example, in the case of those mergers, you need to transfer legislation under the authority of a single minister. Even if there's one minister now overseeing two departments, those laws need to be transferred through Section 97 of the Constitution to the minister who is responsible for those two departments, even if they are running separately. So all that work has already been done. The transfer of serving heads of departments through President's Minute. This is something which has been partially done, but obviously the cases that were referred to by the Honourable and Thuli become relevant here. What when you have two DGs and how will that happen? I will still address that later in the presentation. The agreement with organised labour on the transfer and placement of staff. We are, as we speak, finalising the collective agreement which will underpin, and we'll talk to some of the principles of that, but obviously this is very important and the Minister has emphasized that the engagement with Labour so that they understand what we're doing and why we're doing it is absolutely fundamental. The ring fencing of staff, assets, systems and resources. Now this is done by effective departments because we are transferring a part of a department, say in the case of fisheries. We're transferring it to environment. So you then need to do detailed work at the level of what DPSA does, at the level of what Treasury does, where you identify the staff and the budget and you ring fence them so that these staff and budgets now are going to be transferred progressively through this process of reconfiguration to the new department. So this is a technical process, but this is something we've obviously learned to do because we've done it since 2009, and it's something that is underway. once you actually identify what the staff, assets, systems, resources, and structures, there are assets as well because there are obviously computers, that would be the easiest example, but there are furniture, there's a whole lot of assets which need to move. So all that work is going on at the moment, but these need to be signed off by the executive authorities concerned. At the same time, there need to be service level agreements. So we're moving fisheries to environment, but there needs to be a service level agreement because the budget as it currently stands is with agriculture. So unless there's a proper understanding between those departments and the DGs and DDGs running those departments, you're going to get a mess when it comes to the audit. So these things, there is experience. Whether they absolutely perfected is debatable, but certainly these things have been done over the changes in the last three administrations. the transfer of functions and the approval of macro-organizational structures. So once functions are transferred, either through mergers or splits, then submissions must come by the effective executive authority for the Minister for the Public Service and Administration to make a determination and give concurrence. Then there is the transfer of employees. We'll talk a bit more about that in terms of Section 14 of the Public Service Act in the public interest. and the transfer letters will have to be signed off by the executive authority. And then the application to the National Treasury on the transfer of functions, budget shifts, and budget structure in terms of the estimates of national expenditure, this must be done by the effective departments, and the deadline there is October. And then the finalization of the appropriation bill by the National Treasury, October, November. The listing and renaming of provincial departments at the request of premiers, that will also come. The process is underway, and the presidential proclamation will be drafted to amend Section 1 of the Public Service Act, and the DPSA does that work in support of the presidency. And then attending to the accommodation needs of the executives and departments, that is where Department of Public Works comes in. It is a critical department when it comes to the reconfiguration, because buildings will not be able to accommodate where we have mergers. That may take more than 1 year to actually see a single building, but in the case of merged departments, it's obviously highly desirable to do that as quickly as possible. The issue of government communication and branding is something that GCIS leads, and then ultimately we're looking to a closeout report to be submitted to Cabinet at the end of the year in the final Cabinet meeting. I think just to do a bit of analysis without necessarily stretching it too far is to say that in 2014 we saw an unprecedented growth in the number of deputy ministers compared with the first administration, a growth of 164%. And deputy ministers do not have the same kind of powers that an executive authority has in terms of the Public Service Act and the Public Finance Management Act. And very few pieces of legislation actually assign powers to deputy ministers. There are opportunities for enhancing efficiency and effectiveness. So the merging of existing support services of departments may result in duplication of some posts on the establishment. And like I said at the outset, this whole issue of support services and Program 1 is where we find this. And hence I'm saying here as well, we're saying that 20% of the total cost of employees for Program 1, a ratio of 20% or 20 to 80 would be much more desirable than what we currently have, which is 30 plus. When there are posts that are duplicated, there are opportunities because alternatives need to be explored. We also need to look at possible transfer or secondment to other organs of state that lack capacity and reskilling as well. So I think that's really where the agility comes into this, is where we identify functions that may not be there or need to be expanded. So if you are a support service worker in one capacity or another, for example, we know that the inspectorates in the Department of Employment and Labor are under-resourced. Those are the kind of opportunities that we will have to look at when we look into the detail of it. And then the last point here is about the engagement framework with organized labor, the social plan, and the agreement that we are currently concluding in the PSCBC. In terms of Program 1 in the long term, we do need to look at post-provisioning norms. With a suggestion there. It comes down to the detail, obviously, that comes up in the Commission presentation. If you're looking at management of the PMDS, what is the optimal number of people who are working in HR on performance management? If we look at the possibility of shared services, so if there's one ministry and two departments now sitting in the ministry, how can you share those services? How can you create a shared service arrangement and thereby get greater efficiencies in the support service? And obviously there are examples of shared service models which have been done in different levels of the public service over the last 25 years, and those lessons need to be drawn on in order to get greater efficiencies. This table just shows the change in the number of ministries during the different administrations, as well as the change in the number of departments. And we see that in the first three administrations and now again in the sixth administration, we have 27, 28 ministers, but the number of deputy ministers still shows an increase, although it is a decrease from the fifth administration. And certainly the departments, the number has decreased by seven from the third and fourth administrations. Now, the presidency leads the reconfiguration approach, and it, like we've indicated, the establishment of ministries and departments, the transfer of legislation, renaming, merging, splitting, etc., transfer of functions, resource allocations, introducing new policies and strategies and concomitant resourcing needs falls outside the scope of the NMOG. And the organizational structure design is limited to the macro organizational structures, and it excludes restructuring. So it's about realignment and reconfiguration of the top structure, the first few layers, DG, DDGs, chief directorates, but not necessarily decompressing the entire structure down to the level of entry-level employees. And staff, if they need to be transferred, will obviously transfer with existing conditions of service and retain those until there's a broader process within collective bargaining which deals with conditions of service. Now, in order to do all of this, there's structures which have been put in place. There's a steering committee chaired by the DG and the presidency. There's a national project team and secretariat chaired by the DPSA. And then there are various specialist teams with specialists from DPSA, National Treasury, GCIS, and Public Works that are supporting departments who must have similar work streams to deal with human resources, to deal with finance, to deal with communications, to deal with IT, to deal with buildings, etc., and assets. So this is sort of elaborating on that, the tasks of the presidency and the DPSA in terms of custodianship and project management. And the steering committee really oversees that to ensure that whatever happens in this process, the mandate of government as determined by the President and Cabinet is adhered to provide political referencing to political principles, overall guidance in terms of challenges, resolving and troubleshooting in ambiguity or interpretation issues, unblocking obstacles that may emerge, considering progress reports, ensuring quality assurance of the final products, and the steering committee meets monthly at least. The project teams, there's a departmental project teams, and I've sort of indicated what they are, and they obviously the project management, I don't necessarily need to go through all of that, but that the project team is obviously critical because it's the operational team that drives on behalf of the steering committee. And then the specialist teams, I have referred to that. They give specialist support and advice to departments. They quality assure and consolidate reports by departments, and they compile progress reports in terms of all the specialized functional mandate areas. And then the departmental teams also have specific functions. They work at a departmental level, and they are organized in terms of, like I said, human resource, infrastructure, finance, ICT, legal, and communications. Progress has begun. It's being implemented. I showed you through the project plan a lot of the developments that have happened. So the last slide really gets to the heart of the matter as raised by the Honorable Ntuli, and that is we need to ensure through this process that we optimize the utilization and deployment of existing skills. It may involve reskilling and training, the mechanisms that is used for the transfers is Section 14 of the Public Service Act, whereby an employee may be transferred if he or she requests to or consents to it. In the absence of such a request or consent, after due consideration of the representation of the employee can be transferred if it is in the public interest. So the provisions are there within the public service in the interests of this national project to move employees around. But also, we do face the reality if we have two DGs within a merged department, or if we have two CFOs, or if we have two directors of HR, then from the global position where we sit as the DPSA with the presidency, we would make proposals to the Minister of the Public Service and to the President on how those high-level posts we could deploy where there is duplication in those high-level posts to fill gaps that are also there, because there are a lot of vacancies at the DG echelon. There are some vacancies at the CFO, but as we've also indicated, there are many other organs of state and public entities where we may need to look for deployments to place particular individuals. Thank you very much.
Thank you, DG. This is now open for deliberations by the committee. I see Julie. Mosipe.
Honorable Saibo, you're on the list. Honorable Julie.
Thank you, Chairperson, in the meeting, would love to welcome the presentation by DPSA. I'll be very short, I promise. The reason why I'm going to be very short is, Chair, in the meeting, the document that has been presented to the Portfolio Committee by the department speaks volumes. It says all. It says all. You look at the context, you look at a contextualization of the public service, lessons learned. It is able to tell you the vision of the department, where they are right now, and what are the objectives. Now, my question is, DPSA, I don't know, but I want to check. With all the information that you've put in front of the Portfolio Committee, to me it says you are on the right track, you are working. But your work will evaporate if you don't devise the strategy of touching the ground. You won't touch the ground yourself. But what linkages that you can devise to touch the ground? For instance, with South Africa, we've got the Operation Sugu Massacre that consists of that includes war rooms, etc., which has been declared as by UN as the best strategy to service the people. Now, having done all this work, do you have any chance to sit down with the president and recommend some of the things as the foot soldiers that you are able to touch. Because for me, you've done our work very easy for comparing. Because on the ground we keep on complaining about one, about two, in terms of the number of ministries compared to other countries. First question that you should ask, those countries, are we talking about developed countries or developing countries? When did, if are developing countries, when did they obtain freedom? The landscape, do we have the same landscape as theirs? For instance, I was speaking to the minister to say the road to his homestead where I was staying at the boarding school. You would go to the shower yourself, finish, when the bus is still trying to go down. Then you will finish showering and you would get the bus across because the road was terrible. But today, you go there, and I believe that government spent a fortune for that road, but it was meant for the people of South Africa to be there. Now, our landscape, this amalgamation, is it befitting? You are there now, we are testing the pudding. Is it befitting? Because for me, there are some departments, when you are there, you think that this department is just a department, a private department. You get there, you see the work of the department. I've been the chairperson of arts and culture. If you cloud arts and culture with sports today, of which sports on its own, I felt at sports, I was here at the National Assembly, and we tried to transform a lot of things. The chairperson was Kombela Omdal. When you get there to sports, you are in another world. The transformation of sports going down, going up, arts and culture. I'm just putting this that people think that they are light. Arts and culture is everything for humanity in this country and for the background to make our nation, for our nation building. Clouding it, for me, it won't help us as a nation. I'm just making an example. When they were taking other tasks from environmental affairs to this, I just look at them and said, oh, they don't understand. And the minister will remember that in KZN, environmental affairs was just a tip on agriculture, whereas environmental affairs is huge and vast. Even on the debate, the whole budget vote will be on agriculture, and environmental affairs maybe the last 30 minutes or 20 or so. But when COP17 descended in KwaZulu-Natal, I think everybody began to know it as to, hey, environmental affairs, environmental affairs, environmental affairs. I mean, do you have that opportunity, as you are testing the pudding, to give some advices to the president for some of the things that, of course, it was not overnight. He sat down, thought thoroughly, and thought maybe when the DG said, we mean to deliver less, we'll deliver more with less. That won't happen, DJ. We are a developing country. We are starting from the scratch. I mean, we would love to do so. As Moody's, as Mr. Mlenzo order today, we might wake up under junk status. And it's because the things that we are doing, we are still struggling. 25 years is not enough for us. I mean, that's why I said I'm going to be short, and I hope I'm short enough to say, for me, the document, I can start a song now, it's not Dabula Yonke in South Africa, Ngali document. But how can we touch the ground with this document, particularly with the departments that has been presented by the Public Service Commission, delivering at its best. They are still struggling with the service delivery. Now, as Makulubasi, this is for the second time I'm saying this way, as Makulubasi, DPSA is Makulubasi, and there are these thin lines that you are here, you can't be there, you can't, it's overlapping and so on and so forth. Is there any turnaround strategy to review some of the things for you, DPSA, to touch the ground? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. Regarding early retirement, has there been cases where departments do not have the requisite fund within their budget to consider such personal requests, and employees obliged to consider carrying the associated pension liability? That's the first question. The second question is, there is a detailed plan behind early retirement program on the basis that lump sum should be tax-free as employees volunteering to assist the government to right-size or rebuild the public sector. Thanks.
Honorable Schreiber.
Thanks, Chair. There we go. Okay. I'd just like to start off by taking issue, I think, with what the Minister said in the beginning. To quote what I wrote down here is, the Honourable Minister said, we shouldn't say that the PSC is undermined by not having the power to enforce. Moral power is powerful enough, provided that EAs understand and play their roles. Let's make the system work with the authority that we have. I think that's just not correct based on the evidence. It's been 25 years with the system that we have, and the evidence actually tells us exactly the opposite. The moral power of the PSC is not enough. The moral power of making statements and recommendations and not acting upon them is not enough. And I think as a committee and as a parliament, we need to start seriously thinking about how we actually enhance the teeth that the PSC has, that the DPSA has, that government has, to make sure that when there are recommendations, these things are actually implemented and enforced. So that is a statement. The Minister is welcome to respond, but I think I fundamentally disagree that moral power is enough. We've squandered the opportunity to use moral power, and it's time for real action to act against these ongoing transgressions that we see. And then onto a question based on the presentation. So on page, on the 23rd slide, page 23, I did a quick calculation that shows that our cabinet today is 44% larger than in 94. It's only 15% smaller than under the previous administration. And even worse than that, even worse than that is that there are currently 142% more deputy ministers than in 1994. That's in our current executive. The presentation refers to the first, the second, and the third administrations as, quote, stable periods, on the basis that it had only 27 or 28 departments. I think this accurately implies that the fourth and fifth administrations under President Zuma were hugely unstable. But since the current administration still is bloated with 39 departments, this surely means that this administration should also be classified as unstable. I'd like to ask the DG to respond to that. Related to this is my second question. The fact that the number of ministers was reduced from 34 to 28, but we still have 34 deputy ministers. And the total size of the executive is down from 72 to 64. Now, if the work that's been put into this from the DPSA was being taken seriously, the implication is that our cabinet would actually be much smaller than it is at 64, the executive. So my question is, to put it bluntly, all the work that's gone into this, isn't it ultimately useless when it's up to the president to determine on the basis of political factors the size of cabinet? I don't know what the solution is to that, but clearly if the suggestion here is to cut the cabinet more significantly, or at least that's what I'm reading between the lines from the statements in the presentation, then surely it's not having the desired impact. And frankly, we've had five mergers that we're talking about. It seems overblown to really talk about cutting the executive. Is it really significant, is the question. And then my final point would be, frankly, what is the point of having deputy ministers? I think the DPSA makes an important point by explicitly noting that there's been a 164% increase since 1994. Deputy ministers appear to have no formal powers. There's almost no legislative guidance for their work. So frankly, what is the point? Isn't it merely a political tool for the governing party to give jobs to pals and for those jobs not to be constrained by laws or actually have to do anything when there is no legislative framework to guide deputy ministers? So frankly, what is the point of deputy ministers if it operates in this consequence and accountability-free zone? Thank you, Chair.
Honorable Malazi. Minister.
I'm just experiencing a constraint in terms of time on my side.
Yeah, you indicated.
But could I, having made that excuse, just say one or two things on what has been, some of the things that have been said, by which I think they rather get responded to by myself rather than the teacher.
Yeah, okay. No, you did indicate that to me, Honorable Minister. Therefore, I think I will give you that opportunity to respond to those.
Yes.
That have been
Thank you very much. There's a question which the Honorable Member repeated twice, whether there's a link between this process and the President. There definitely is. NMOC is driven by the DG in the presidency, and then there are all these teams that we're talking about. But as public service, we realize that we can't just sit and then say we are getting more closer and so on. And there have been sessions between the president and ourselves as a department to deal with some of the things on an ongoing basis. The right size of government and the question of deputy ministers and so on, the question that is arising, I think it's a question that we can't deal with in terms of question and answer. It's a question of us as South Africans having to ask ourselves, and in a committee like this, this platform offers a lab, in my view, where we can exchange views and debate matters in the interest of our country. Not that I would discourage a situation where we get sort of frustrated and get a bit sound like demoralized and start saying, but all this work, what is the impact and so on.
I rather would want us to be encouraged by the fact that on this table we put these matters, and we're putting it to a leadership here in this platform to debate, so that we can then say, how best do we take these ideas forward, whatever idea. I think if we would be engaged in the process of building the country, if we do so, because these are the things we know, the system of political parties and ideologies and constraints and so on. But we need to rise above that. I think that's the call this particular time, that we need to rise above all those constraints and start emphasizing in terms of our debates what is going to work in the country. Not allow for a minute to be sunk by frustration or any other thing. That would be my view, Chair. And I trust your leadership, that you would lead us such that we rise above all these matters and say, how do we get across on issues that we find one another coming from this committee and say, but this is the right thing. If you live in a village that seems to be dominated by darkish activities, people who are carrying knives, all the time, you don't give up. You don't give up. You say, what are the windows through which you can try and make up, and so that the village next time become the best village. So I'm saying, here is information, and this information is real, coming from our NMOC, and we add things like, let's compare, which are not necessarily strictly NMOC. We're putting our own NMOC process, but we're consolidating it so that when we talk, we're not working from a narrow path of just saying, look at this, this is what's happening, but we're opening up so that we develop ideas and see what's working elsewhere. What we do, Honorable Ntuli, we don't confine ourselves to one side of the country. We've thrown things, something about Asia, something about Europe, something about North America. We could have brought in South America. We brought in Africa as well. Just to broaden our ideas and start debating and rise from here with something that we think will work. On the first comment that the Honourable Member made, we can debate whether authority in the form of carrying whatever that would enhance that authority is more powerful than the power of morality. I would say, by and large, out of the 59 million people that are in South Africa, quite a good more than 40 million, if not more than 50 million, are good law-abiding people. They don't need anyone to tell them, drive your car with the speed. They go to shops, they don't steal anything. They are excellent human beings. They are not governed by police left and right and a gun and somebody threatening them. Quite more than 50 million. Maybe I'm exaggerating. More than 55 million, I'm underrating. Maybe more than 55. If you look at the percentage of people who really are worrying us, I wonder if it would go beyond a million. And yet, we tend to succumb. Let's not be governed by what is evidence for now, but let's be governed by what the objective, what is the ultimate good, and let's strengthen ourselves and take up that, because the power of what is right over what is wrong must always prevail. It must prevail all the time, no matter what the situation may be difficult, but it must prevail. And the Honourable Member is one of those members who are relatively young and should use both the physical energy and the energy of the brain to come up with new ideas to get us what... Because numbers are on our side. numbers are on our side, I can tell you, across spheres of government, across the color line, across beliefs and all those things. Numbers, if you said, let's line up two lines, who wants South Africa to do right things and so on in all aspects, you will be amazed. You will be left with nothing on the wrong side. So let's swallow the wrong and drive it down and make the good rise and prevail and dominate. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chair. So I'd like to confine myself to that, to the document and what it doesn't say, because I think there's detail there that would have been useful as part of the discussion around the process of the reconfiguration of government and where it is. And one part of it is there's reference that's being made to the discussions with Labour in terms of the transfer of civil servants across other departments. But what's missing in there is the whole discussion about the consequence of the reconfiguration of government in terms of the reduction of the number of civil servants that is going to be necessary when you look at the size of government, and this whole talk that has been dominant about how do we have a much more smaller but efficient government given the size of the public service wage bill, and where that process is in terms of the discussion with Labour. And secondly, it's around the actual cost and time frame linked to this reconfiguration of the government in terms of what has been spent up to date as part of that process and allocated to conclude the entire process of the reconfiguration of government, and the timelines that will eventually result in either entities that were transferred from one department to another or departments that have been aligned, so that even in the process of engaging with these various entities and departments, we're able to link those discussions to the transfer of resources that those departments are now responsible for and what drives them. Because ultimately, the reconfiguration was also done to have synergy and that there is alignment of entities and departments and also functions so that there isn't duplication. And that also manifests itself even in this committee, for instance, when it comes to holding accountable entities that were previously with the Department of Communication, which are, you know, with the DPME. And I recognize that that is not the purpose of this particular meeting, that example. But in terms of the broader view, in terms of timelines allocated to that, so that we know this is not an endless process, and also the resources that are being spent in there. And lastly, if I were to put the DG to a corner, in terms of all the studies that we have done and the recognition that there is gaps in terms of how do you best make use of, one, the number, the role, and the size of the functions of deputy ministers, what would be the recommendation in terms of the size there on the number of deputy ministries that we need based on the current reconfigured size of cabinet, so that we optimize resources that are in there? Thanks, Chair.
Thank you. Honorable Somo.
Thank you, Chair. Probably let me start by appreciating that the department have taken us into confidence. Yeah. Notwithstanding that, you haven't engaged the labor as it were, because other issues also they might affect the discussions with labor and the relationship thereof of government and the labor as it were. So I just want to appreciate that point. But also I think, Honorable Malazi, I think I'm excited with the approach that he has taken, that seeks to come with a suggestion. Because also, as the portfolio committee, we don't also just consume and react. We need also to say how best we think things can be done. Like the previous speakers making examples of how many cabinet vis-a-vis deputy ministers. But I think some of the issues also as members, which must not even try to frustrate us, because are beyond our control, which are more political as it were, because ideologically also the school of thought depends who governs the country at that time. But I appreciate the angle that the minister has taken in terms of being diplomatic as ever, so that also we move within the same page and one level, as it were. But I'm not making a political speech, Chair. Picking up from Honorable Malatsi's question, if I may, let me just quickly go to my note here, Chair. I'm going to close this first, yeah. Okay. To say there is this timeline that has been put, if I'm correct. So I'm making a statement as a question also, so that I can also just build on Honorable Malatsi's question, that you are expected to have sort of done or tried to come up with a fixed model for South Africa with South African characteristics within 10 months. One, when does this 10 months start? When does it end? Because in between that, there should be some targets so that we can monitor also that is there any progress, what are the limitations, and how best can we assist in that space. But linked to that, Chair, building up on the same question, is the process outsourced or is insourced? Because the how much part of it also probably it will raise an interest that who drives this project, is it internal or external?
Okay.
But also when you reconfigure the structure as it were and the functions, are we going to take note of the technology, which programs say it will be coupled with reskilling, redeployment, but also technology runs a huge space in terms of public administration. Because I, for one, for myself, in my responsibility, if I had a choice, I wouldn't have support who administratively who supports me administratively, because I've got this, I've got this, and I can type. So why do I need a secretary? But I'm raising it in terms of the departments, that there are some workbodies who, not because they are qualified, they are misplaced, and also they happen to be paper pushers. That's why the signing of anything, when you ask for the report, you must talk to this one must talk to this one, and this one is too big to be talked by this one, then it doesn't happen. But I think the whole intention of reconfiguration of government public services, it will seek to address that. The other one, Chair, which will be my question, but also I'm sure Prof. Lavin, you'll also leave the political issues and take note of them, and the minister should respond to us in writing on those issues. The other one, Chair, is that let's say an employee, because I know there's a subtle expected or unpronounced request that also public servants are encouraged also to take an early retirement. I'm choosing words very carefully here because I haven't had government clearly saying that, as I choose my words on that one. If, let's say, I apply for early retirement, then within 30 days I change my mind, what is the EA's responsibility, legally speaking? Can they then decline because I've applied already? Or if it's after 30 days, then it kicks in as an approved, or it's assumed as an approved application, as it were. The other one, which is not necessary for this presentation purpose, Chair, but also in view of the perceived future, in terms of the shortfall of 30 billion in government in terms of salaries and wages, is it because of the salary wage negotiations agreements that have been agreed in 2018, and how far are we? But as a separate, when you come back, you must respond to that. How far are we in terms of meeting the agreed then line items? Because it's not salary wages as a figure, but also benefits and all that. But I'm saying that one, park it. Don't even attempt to because it's a separate discussion altogether. The other one, which will be my last point, Chair. I know the minister previously said that he's not a ministerial handbook minister,
but I will still ask this question. Does the ministerial handbook also seek to address program one in terms of addressing the so-called inverted commas, I'm using that word very carefully, so-called perceived bloated public services, it were. And I thank you very much.
Honorable Saber.
Thanks, Chair. I'll keep it short since I've gotten the chance. But I feel, first of all, just for us as a committee chair, that I don't think it's right for the minister to leave when there are issues on the table, and for members to be given the opportunity to respond to that without the minister here. So I understand that he mentioned something about time to you, but I think as a committee, this is very important that we have these debates, as the minister rightly said. And so in future, I would request that the minister stay, especially after he's raised issues, and then leaves the committee to deal with it without his presence. The second thing is raising the need for debate and suggestions. That is exactly what we are doing here. The suggestion is that, first of all, on the point about the Public Service Commission, it's time for us to look into changing the law so that the PSC gets more power to implement recommendations, or at least given the ability to more closely follow and ensure that there are repercussions when someone else doesn't implement the recommendations. So that is a tangible suggestion that is made. But now it is a real shame that the minister isn't here. Then the second point about the questions or frustration that the minister mentioned, I think it is very out of touch in the South Africa of today to think that people are not frustrated. South Africans are hugely frustrated with the lack of consequence management that the PSC Commissioner raised here. So we represent the people of South Africa. When the people of South Africa are frustrated, we are not here to mollycoddle anyone. We are here to say moral authority has been systematically eroded in this country. We need to create legislative tools as this committee and parliament to ensure that people are held to account and that there is consequence management. So to suggest that somehow this committee doing its work by trying to address the frustration that's out there in society is somehow inappropriate, I think is just not the right way to approach it. So those are the two things which I'm now saying to you, Chair. I wish I could say that to the Minister, because then we can have the discussion and the debate, but I really hope in future we will put these things on the table and the Minister will be available until we've ironed them out and we can seriously look at these practical suggestions. It's high time, Chair.
No, the Minister has not run away. He indicated to me, but if there are some discussions that the committee needs to have with the minister, we can arrange that. We can arrange. He has not run away. He hasn't. Honorable Manel.
Thanks, Chair. I think you've addressed the first point, that I think other matters may still need to be taken up with the minister at a particular time, so that's not like not held accountable. But I'm just heeding to the counsel that the minister gave before he left, that indeed we do not look at the problem today, but in the state's future and what we think could be done. Maybe just to start by a point that says you were bold in purchasing a document like this at this time, and that we must look at these issues. Maybe from there the question to be asked is that your focus in the main has been on high level, the departments here at national level. Because whatever we discuss now, we must also link it with other discussions on the other side. That TPME, for example, looks at an integrated planning framework, which will also look at the other spheres of government. Now, at what point do you look at that when you look at the configuration of government, your provinces, the local municipalities? I'm raising this thing because at the time of looking at professionalization of the public service, amongst other things has been the upward and downward mobility within the service, which will then ultimately get to a point of a single public service. And if you were to look at the challenges about delivery, you will then understand that part of the problem is that you can also have over-skilled people not doing anything at this level, whilst at another sphere of government, you have non-delivery, because from the revenue base of those municipalities, they will never be able at any given day to attract skilled people like metros would do, given their budget. So I'm just saying, if we look at public service in that score, I think maybe it's time to look at that bit. Maybe let me venture here to say that I think on the side of the public service, we must move also from an understanding that there was already legislation being introduced along the lines of professionalization, such that we do not get to a point where we say during elections public service stops because we do not know who would come in. But in the process of appointments, and that you attract professionals that serve the public service, to a point that during elections, like I would say, when parties go out to campaign, it's a duty of the public service people to programmatize each of the manifestos and put it on the side, because you do not have results beforehand. It can happen either way, but you'll still be a public service. The notion of a state that belongs to the people of the country, not really that a party, but a party at a given time presides over the state by a mandate, and that's what democracy is about, by a mandate given by the people. But that state is still expected to serve all the citizens of the country. So I just thought I should raise that those two points. Thank you.
Okay, Honorable Mutsi.
Honorable Chairperson, I've got a concern. My concern is we are raising questions, and then we are posing questions to the other side of the table. And then this line is for us to ask questions, not to answer questions that we are raising. So really, I'm very much concerned if us will have to answer questions while the questions must be answered by the other table. Thank you.
I don't think we have done so. If the inference is to the comment I made to the minister did indicate that to me. And it would have been unfair on my part not to register that to the committee. I think I have such powers as a chair.
Can you
respond where necessary? But if there are questions you think you are unable to respond to, we will arrange the minister to be here so that he responds to questions.
Okay. Look, I think maybe I can begin with the Honourable Malatsi, and then I can, in the process, try and engage with some of the issues that have come up. Or rather, let me start with Honourable Mutsepe, because you asked specific questions about early retirement,
yeah,
which isn't really part of what we were discussing here. But early retirement technically is Section 16.6 of the Public Service Act, and those provisions allow public servants between the ages of 55 and 60 to take early retirement. And the particular dispensation which is currently being discussed with Labour is really about the penalties that arise if you take early retirement being covered. But the aim was never about right-sizing. The aim of the early retirement as it evolved the announcement of the Minister of the current Minister of Finance still during the fifth administration. The stance of the previous minister was to see whether we could find ways in which we can bring more young people into the public service, because the wage of a young person at entry level is much less than the salary of a public service servant who served for the entire life or a substantial proportion of the life and is now retiring. So it's not a severance, it's not a retrenchment, it's within the Public Service Act, a mechanism which was looked at as a way of trying to not reduce headcount, but allow young people in and maybe making savings on the salary bill. On the issue of whether EAs can decline an application, yes, they definitely can decline an application, both in terms of the laws that stipulated and the dispensation which is currently being discussed. An executive authority can say, these are skilled people, and I've heard them in the discussion saying these things. We don't need to lose certain skills, and there's people who are older, experienced public servants, and we shouldn't rush to retire them. But in other cases, they may agree to a particular case. So it's certainly not a done deal when a public servant makes an application for early retirement, whenever it happens, in terms of the law at any space in time and the current situation now. Yes, I think, you know, we've tried to look at public administration. That's what we try and do at the DPSA and engage with the committee in a way that also empowers the committee, as well as ourselves by getting ideas from the honourable members. And I think it's important to say, to make one point before maybe I get on to, you know, some of these issues raised by Honourable Malatsi, and that the big challenge globally, because we have the privilege when we serve as public servants to travel into international forums on public administration, public trust is actually one of the biggest global challenges when it comes to public administration and politics. I was in the OECD a few months ago in Paris. The whole theme was about public trust and citizen engagement. That's what it was all about. It was also about the use of technology, how to use technology to get greater participation by citizens in actual decision making, for example, at local government level. So in public admin, there is the whole thing about regimentation, rules. I didn't come from the world of rules. I ended up in the world of rules. I came from the world of development. Even as an academic, before I joined the public service, actually land reform is my area, as a matter of fact, which I have been involved in policy research, participatory, etc., etc. So I'm not really a person who falls naturally where I am, but I'm in the world of rules. But the future of public service, which relates to a lot of the questions that have come up, the technology of the fourth industrial revolution, those are the things we need actually to talk about, all of us in South Africa. How will it impact on the workplace in the public service? If you go to Steve Biko Hospital now in Pretoria, and you go to the pharmacy there, there are robots which are dispensing medicines. Now, to what extent will that become a broader practice within public administration? For example, if we're talking land reform, agricultural development, there are technologies in Kenya. They're using them extremely effectively. Extension officers don't go out every day. They use technology to advise and support farmers through the agricultural cycle. So there's a lot of opportunities to improve the way we work through technology. So I'm saying we need to focus on rules, but we also need to focus on innovation and doing things differently. The rules often, I've even heard the honourable members saying it around the room today, will not necessarily bring the outcomes we're looking for. Compliance will not necessarily bring them, but it's critical to have compliance, just as it's critical to do the basics as an individual in your everyday life. So, but that will not necessarily, the big game changers in the state and public service and society is around how we harness the innovative side and the capacity of technology to change the way in which we govern. The consequence of the reduction of numbers of civil servants. The framework at the moment is a reorganization framework. That's the reality. There's no retrenchment tool which we have. To introduce a retrenchment tool now for any government, it would not really be possible, to do that. There is a wage bill issue and a discussion with Labour. The Minister has referred to the meeting of the 20th of September, where there will be a major interaction around this. Because I think he has realized that it's better to actually open up and talk about these things and try and reach a consensus and an understanding than to come and try and impose things which would be very difficult for the society right now. So the reconfiguration, it doesn't necessarily have costs which are hidden or unforeseen or anything, because it's not an outsourced thing. We're not working with consultants. Truly speaking, as the DG of DPSA in the year of 2009, I was called and asked to design this whole thing, and we worked with a small team of legal experts, of subject matter experts, and we came up with this very process. It was designed then, it's the same process. It doesn't involve consultants, it doesn't involve additional expenditure, and the timelines are really achievable. It requires cooperation and good energy from public servants. It requires good organizational culture, to be honest, because you actually have to co-govern things during this transition phase. So if you're transferring people, say me, say I'm a DDG in the DPSA, even with an internal restructuring process, if we're moving realigning our structure, it means that for a certain point in time in a budget cycle, I will have to co-manage with someone else the budget. And that's really what is happening at the departmental level. There's interdepartmental co-governance of certain things. That unfolds. I do think that there will be certain areas in terms of transfer of functions where there will be pushback and resistance, but it's not the dominant theme now, and it hasn't been the dominant theme before. So there will be inevitably disruptions in service delivery, if you like, through a process of national macro reconfiguration. But one has not identified that. I think the key risk is managing the relationship with labor. That, truly speaking, is the key risk. That if we can sign this agreement, which we are poised to do, then we will be able to move on the understanding that everyone will find their place somewhere. But one is also coming with other real issues about the need to look at support services and to how to optimally use support services. So rather than having people who are not productive, if we're going to raise productivity in the public service, we need to say that there are certain functions which could be performed which will add value. For example, the Honourable Member is talking about lack of compliance with rules. Whether it's the Commission, DPSA, whoever, we need to think about inspectorates. And I think for me that's something that I do want to talk about increasingly. And I do talk about it when I've given the opportunity, and no one is hostile to it, to raise productivity. If we can have inspectorates that would ensure that public service rules, directions from the Commission or whatever are complied with, then we should look at inspectorates. And we should look at technologically empowering them so they don't go out there with clipboards, but we find tools and methods which allow rapid appraisal in a substantive way using technology to look at whether there are improvements regarding compliance. I do think that these are the things that we need to look at, truly speaking. So I don't think it's a risk of becoming an endless process, but there may be little pockets where you find it's a protracted process. All I could say on the issue of deputy ministers is there's no real ideal type of what would the ideal number. We've shared the numbers because you could maybe extract whether or not those are ideal numbers. It also depends, again, it's about human beings and human capabilities, because that's the big thing with public service. It's a lot about human capabilities. So if ministers work well with their deputy ministers, they assign them certain responsibilities, you can have greater impact. So that's how I would try and answer that particular one. I think the issue of the other spheres of government, maybe what's worth mentioning is that one of the minister's priorities, as we are aware, is implementing the Public Administration and Management Act. That particular legislation has got a history. It had a predecessor bill which never ultimately saw the light of day, but it was much more extensive because it gave empowering provisions. Because really what these things must be about, the question is, where do we put the people who are in civil service? What is the optimal location? Do we put them in offices in national? Do we put them in provinces? Do we put them on the ground in local? The numbers talk. The numbers talk to us. You know, the largest number, 900,000 plus, are in provinces. 300,000 to 400,000 are in national. 250,000 in local. What are those numbers telling us? Of course, some national departments have presence at local level. Water affairs, rural development, land reform, agriculture, and so on, national competencies with presence at local level. But that is really the question. It was ultimately this whole initiative around the constitutional provision that there is one public administration which affects everyone, from the judiciary to the legislature to public entities, public sector, public service. It's all there. It's all there in Chapter 10 of the Constitution. Those constitutional values and principles, which include efficiency, effectiveness, accountability, affect every branch of government. Those are the principles of public administration. So where do we put the people to optimally deliver on those principles? I think, Honorable Manelli, you're asking that question. And the sad reality is that the PAMA provisions on transfer are even weaker than the provisions in Public Service Act, and the provisions on Public Service Act do not pertain to intersphere. It's only national and provincial. So the idea of people moving in the national interest, I don't think is anti-democratic, in the public interest. Sorry, it's not putting in the public interest. But it's a very important principle. If we're not only going to get the configuration right, as well as getting the people right. So we have people, we have process, we have technology, and we have structure. Today's topic is about structure. Structure, however we put it, is just a scaffold. It's how we do the work, how we utilize our human capabilities in the state, in society. Remember the comments on developmental states. How were they successful? They worked with communities on the ground. They worked with business. The partnerships in Korea between the government and business, same in China, that is what underpins their huge growth rates. That's a fact of the matter. They work with people on the ground. How do they empower people, meeting their needs? Those are really the issues. The structure is just the scaffold. Thank you very much, Honorable Chair.
Honorable members, we are facing serious time constraints, and we have serious time constraints, because by 1 o'clock we must be out of here. But we have some reports to consider before 1 o'clock. I suggest the adoption of the first quarterly reports be deferred to the next meeting. And then we allow Mr. Mwepe to take us through this whole process of the appointment of the commissioner. I see members nodding.
If I may ask, what is the deadline for the adoption of the quarterly reports in terms of parliament's rules?
I know we are. We still have.
We'll be okay then.
It will be okay for next week. Yes. Mr. Wepe, can you? You may leave. Commissioner, sorry for that. I should have indicated that.
Thanks, Chairperson. Good day, honourable members. I would like to. My presentation is just about to take members through the processes and the procedure for filling a post in the Public Service Commission. As you are aware, honourable members, we have received an ATC from Speaker's office requesting the committee to fill in the vacant position of a commissioner for the Public Service Commission. Members, the PSC has got 14 commissioners all in all, both in national and provinces, but we are responsible for recommending to the president only 5 commissioners that are based at national PSC. Okay, sorry for that. Okay, in terms of Section 196 of the Constitution, Section 8, it stipulates that a commissioner should be appointed in terms of subsection 7A, that a committee of the National Assembly that is proportionally composed of members of all parties represented in the Assembly approved by the National Assembly resolution. Therefore, we have to, as a committee, interview as we are filling in this position. We have to ensure that all parties are represented as we are filling the position. And Section 229 of the Rules of the National Assembly clearly indicate that Portfolio Committee may appoint a subcommittee from among its members to assist the committee. That's the rules of the National Assembly 9th edition, where it indicates that we may appoint a subcommittee to do that. And the purpose of establishing a subcommittee is to avoid the following. In case where a candidate, if the whole committee will sort of interview the candidate might feel sort of intimidated, especially when the panel is not sort of accessible, because we've got 11 members in our committee. And secondly, the interview might even take longer as anticipated. If you still remember, members, when Parliament was interviewing the position for the Public Protector, it took Parliament for over 2 days just for the interviews. So those are the factors that we are trying to sort of minimize the risk of running the interviews over the 2 days. And the longer it takes for the interview, and the panel member might even end up losing track record of candidates in terms of their submission or their performance. And therefore, the committee should then decide whether it consider nominating among its members a subcommittee to run with the process of the recruitment of a commissioner. A subcommittee panel of 7 members, including the chairperson, will then lead the interview process. Therefore, we will only, if the committee agrees, Chair, will only have 7 members to run the process. And then each political party represented in the portfolio committee shall nominate a representative to the subcommittee. And composition, as suggested, is based on the proportional representative, is as follows. We'll have 4 members from the African National Congress and 1 from Democratic Alliance and 1 from Economic Freedom Fighters and one member from either IFP or NFP. And the subcommittee will lead the interview process by asking structured questions to be approved by the panel members. The structured questions, we will develop the structured question and then present the structured question before the committee before we continue with the interviews. The purpose of that is to avoid a situation where candidates feel that the questions, we've posed different questions to the candidates. And for the purpose of even when members are engaging on who the best candidate is, then if the questions were structured, then it would be easier for members to measure a candidate based on the structured question rather than unstructured one. And however, there will be a follow-up questions that would be allowed for members if the members feel that a candidate didn't answer satisfactorily. There will be one follow-up question that a member can make a follow-up to a candidate. And the subcommittee will then report to the main committee with regard to the recruitment process and recommend a candidate for the appointment. Immediately when we are done at the subcommittee level, when we'll be considering the report, we'll have to account to the main committee for all the members that didn't partake in the subcommittee, so that it should be a report of a committee rather than a subcommittee. That's the end of my presentation, Chair. Thanks. Oh, okay, before that, Chair. Well, there is a program, I understand, that members, they do have, that outline the processes in terms of where are we now and then when are we anticipating to finalize this process of the recruitment. Thanks.
I have seen that members, they like to prolong speaking, but now I want to provide some direction here so that we are not chucked out of this meeting. You have seen how many members each party must have. The suggestion I'm making is that each party must submit the names of those two to the secretary of the committee. Because if I allow you to speak, we will be chucked out of this before we are finished. Now, but you can, I will allow you to endorse what I'm saying. If you don't feel comfortable with it, fine. I see Nduli, I see Lesoma and Dr. Schreiber.
Chair, I would love to move, according to the recommendation by the chairperson, to move that all parties submit their names to the portfolio committee secretary. Thank you.
Okay. You must also... Yeah. Okay. Honourable Sommer.
Okay, Chair, thank you. The submission should be not later than Friday midday for the names. That's one. I'm just building up on the suggestion. Okay, that's the second one. But also, because some of us were new, is that in terms of the, I know that it's an extract from the Act itself in terms of requirements, but also the subcommittee will discuss that in terms of the other requirements that we need, so that we don't have any issues around that one, based on consistency in terms of that approach, as it were, because it's the same commission, it's just that feeling of vacancy. Let me just stop there, Chair. I'm fine. We'll submit the name.
I'm fine with the suggestion as well. Just to quickly confirm the calculation of the proportionality of this committee, who does that, and briefly, how did you come to this breakdown? Sorry, this might be just because of being a new member.
Okay. I did not think that would come up, Honorable, and can you answer
that? Yeah, all right. In terms of the proportionality, we have looked at we have just developed it by ourselves, taking into consideration the composition of the committee. Because all the parties, and even from the be guided by the previous committees, because it's not for the first time this committee is embarking on this process. So we always consider the composition first in terms of the number of members from the ruling party, and then the number of the members that we have in the committee, in the committee itself, rather than being guided to what is actually the proportional representative in the House. Yes.
Thank you, Chair.
That's it.
Yeah, just for information.
Okay.
Just a quick one before you close. I know you are going to close, but it's important that we need to have those meetings. But also, secondly, we have been raising issues in previous meetings, and I ask that in the next draft program of the next quarter when you are coming from business must incorporate those issues, even to speak two times in a week. Because we must be sure those issues, you can't say the next meeting must be started, yes, and we're not taking care of or paying attention on that. So that's an appeal, and I hope to see it. Thank you, Chair.
Yeah. Okay, no.
I see members nodding in agreement with what Honorable Soma is saying. Yes. Fine, thank you.
Okay, just one last thing, Chairperson. Based on our program for the PSC, we have indicated that the advert will run this weekend. But unfortunately, we are sort of running late in terms of getting the quotation. But we'll still have within 2 weeks or whatever time to advertise. So it will be advertised the next weekend, not this weekend.
But we're behind the
sheet. Yeah. So as long as the advert runs for long enough,
yeah,
I think that's the main thing, yeah, we should keep in mind.
Honourable members, thank you very much.
Thank
I
you,
don't
sir.
Have any announcement to make. Thank you very much. The meeting is adjourned.
Thank you.
Next time I'm going to strictly stand for meeting time.